You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Rob Kajiwara, who is an Okinawan Hawaiian singer, songwriter, and visual artist. In 2017, he was made a cultural ambassador for his ancestral village of Nakagusuku, Okinawa. In 2018, he was also made a cultural ambassador / special envoy for Ke Aupuni o Hawaii, the Hawaiian kingdom, in order to share Hawaiian history, culture, and issues in Ryukyu. Rob Kajiwara recently organized a petition to the White House about military bases in Okinawa, and some of us joined him in delivering it there on January 7th. We'll talk about that, and Rob will tell you how to correctly pronounce all of the words I've just said. Rob Kajiwara, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Maybe we can start if you could briefly tell us about your background as an Okinawan Hawaiian.
Yeah, so for those who might not be familiar, there are a lot of Okinawans living in Hawaii, around 100,000. And we have a very strong community here, a strong cultural identity, and a strong link remaining with our ancestral ties to Okinawa. So I grew up in this community. I'm fourth generation Okinawan Hawaiian, and I've always felt a very strong connection with my Okinawan identity. And so that's why many of us, not only in Hawaii, but elsewhere overseas as well, we wanted to support, we wanted to do whatever we could to support Okinawan issues, and especially this issue currently going on at Hinoko.
And you have friends and family there and have been there?
Yes, yes. I still have a lot of close friends and relatives over there. I actually do live there part of the year. I have an apartment there. It's still in my ancestral village, yes.
For people who are really out of the loop, where is Okinawa? What is Okinawa, and what is the situation there now, and how did it come to be that way?
Okay, so Okinawa was an independent nation known as Ryukyu up until 1879, when the Japan government invaded and annexed it. They also did something similar with Korea and China and many other nations in the Asia Pacific. Unfortunately, after the war ended, World War II, all those other nations received their independence back except for Ryukyu, Okinawa. So Okinawa is just the name of the largest and most populated island in the Ryukyu island chain, but there are many, many more islands in Ryukyu. But the situation with Okinawa is that the Japanese government has long been very prejudiced against Okinawans, which is why they prefer to put the military bases in Okinawa just to get them out of the way so that they don't have to interfere in the Japanese homeland. So you can see there's a lot of prejudice from Japanese against Okinawans.
And are we talking about Japanese military bases or somebody else's military bases?
So these are U.S. military bases. However, the Japanese government is trying to restart its military. After World War II, the Japanese were banned from having a military, and you know they willingly agreed to this. But nowadays, they're trying to restart their military. And so myself and many others, we believe that Japan envisions the current U.S. military bases in Okinawa eventually being their own Japanese military bases.
And Japan, we should note, is still banned from having a military by Article 9 of its constitution, correct?
Yes, that's correct. But the current Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, he wants to change that article to allow Japan to restart its military.
And so currently they are U.S. military bases, and for the immediate future, that's what they'll be. How many of them are there, and what's happening in terms of potentially moving and the building of a new one?
So there's a lot of U.S. military bases in Okinawa. Now, keep in mind that Okinawa is just a small island, and when compared to Japan, so Okinawa has 70% of Japan's military bases, yet makes up just 0.6% of Japan's total landmass. So you can see that Okinawa is really quite small, and it's carrying a hugely unfair share of the military burden.
And support for these military bases is, of course, much stronger in the rest of Japan than in Okinawa, correct?
Right. So the Japanese, they don't have to deal with the military bases, right? Because, you know, they're saying, not in my backyard. So it's the Okinawans who have to deal with this hugely unfair share burden. And the Okinawans are strongly against any new bases. Now, many Okinawans are strongly against all bases, although not all. Some Okinawans call for a withdrawal of all the military bases, but not all are saying that. But 80% of Okinawans agree that this new base at Tenoko, Okinawa, is a bad idea. That 80% do not want this new base.
And is that because of the particular location and environmental destruction, or is it because it's just one too many and there are already so many darn bases there?
Well, it's for both of those reasons and many more. This base at Hinoko is going to cause a lot of problems, everything from cost to environmental to security to feasibility. There are just so many things wrong with it. And unfortunately, most of the rest of the world is not aware of this.
And, you know, I think to the extent that much of the U.S. public is aware of anything that the U.S. military does, and that's very little, there's this common sense that it has something to do with democracy and defending democracy and spreading democracy. If the people of Okinawa had democratic say over what happened in Okinawa, these bases wouldn't be being built, right?
That's right. Yeah, the Okinawan people are strongly against at least this many bases. Not necessarily all the bases, but having such a huge amount of bases taking up Okinawa. So, the U.S. military takes up 20% of Okinawa's land mass and 40% of its arable land. Yet it makes up just 5% of the Okinawan economy. So you can see it's a huge economic burden to Okinawa. And so the Okinawan people are overwhelmingly against any new bases, including this proposed base at Hinoko. And they've routinely used their democratic voices to express their discontent with this decision. And yet both the Japanese and U.S. government continue to ignore and violate the democratic will of the Okinawan people.
And the recently elected governor of Okinawa agrees with the Okinawan people and has visited Japan and the United States and not really been listened to. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. Governor Denny Tamaki, he was elected this past September, largely on the premise of stopping this base at Hinoko. That was easily his largest and most notable campaign promise. And the people responded. He was victorious in the election. He had the largest election margin in Okinawan history so far. So that just shows you how strongly Okinawans feel about the issue. And yes, he has been traveling to Japan. He did travel to Washington, D.C. Not that long ago. And yet he was pretty much ignored by both the Japanese and U.S. government. And in fact, the Japanese government under Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, he was actually trying to actively prevent Governor Tamaki from gaining audience with U.S. government officials to discuss this matter.
We're speaking with Rob Kajiwara, who, among other things on this issue, started a petition to President Donald Trump. Rob, can you tell us about that petition?
Yeah, so I've been watching this situation very closely for a long time, and I'm very concerned about what's going on, because back in December 14th, the Japanese government decided to go ahead and start with the construction of this base at Henoko, even though the Okinawan government has made it illegal. So the Japanese government is blatantly violating the rights of the Okinawan people and their democratically elected government. The Okinawan prefecture government originally scheduled a referendum to be held on the matter for February 24th, just to allow the Okinawan people to vote and decide whether or not they wanted this base. And yet the Japanese government decided to go ahead and start the construction prematurely in the hopes of crushing the will of the Okinawan people, hoping that they'll just roll over and give up and say, well, I guess we can't do anything now. We might as well accept the base. So they wanted to do that before the referendum. So last month, I started a petition on the White House's website asking President Trump to please intervene and stop the construction at least until after the people hold their referendum.
The people in Okinawa, we should note, are not just electing officials who agree with them and hoping to be allowed a referendum vote, but are engaged in all kinds of nonviolent activism and resistance. I mean, this is a big deal in Okinawa, isn't it?
That's right. People in Okinawa have been protesting this base for over 20 years, which is why it's been delayed for so long. And a lot of the protesters, especially the regular protesters, are elderly. They're retired, so you know, they don't have to work. So they've decided to devote their retirement to trying to protect the land and sea at Henoko and to trying to stop this base. And they've been out there protesting for over 1,600 days straight. Even in bad weather, they've been out there for over 1,600 days straight. So this is big news all over Okinawa. It's routinely in the media over there.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, a lot of people outside of Okinawa are just not very much aware of it.
And the petition to Trump, how many signatures is a White House website petition supposed to get that will supposedly have the president respond to it? And how many signatures does this one have?
So according to the White House's rules, a White House petition has to have at least 100,000 signatures within the first 30 days of its opening in order to guarantee a response from the White House. We hit that mark within 10 days. We got 100,000 signatures within the first 10 days. We currently have over 200,000 signatures. And this just shows you the amount of support there is for Henoko and the amount of people who oppose this military base. This number is particularly remarkable considering the fact that we've gotten virtually no U.S. press coverage and that Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Japan has been actively trying to censor people from seeing this petition or hearing about it or being able to sign it.
We did an event about this petition standing right in front of the White House that, as far as I know, got extensive media coverage in Okinawa and in Japan and virtually nothing in the United States. Am I right about that?
Yes, that's very right. The Okinawan and the Japanese press have been very much interested in this petition movement pretty much since day one. Unfortunately, the U.S. media has shown almost zero interest at all.
How big a story? It's hard for me to tell, being too ignorant to read the Japanese articles. How big a story is it in Japan compared to in Okinawa and compared to in the United States?
So in Okinawa, you can imagine this is huge news. It's been all over the mainstream Okinawan media. In Japan, it's also big news. It's not quite as huge as in Okinawa, but it's still big news. We've been on a lot of the mainstream Japanese media. But in the United States, we've gotten virtually no coverage. We've gotten some coverage from nonprofit organizations who are interested in things like anti-war and environmental protection. We've gotten a little bit of coverage in this regard, but basically nothing from the mainstream U.S. media.
Yeah, and in the United States, there was a recent congressional election, and there's a bunch of new Congress members, and they are supposedly better and more progressive and more interested in peace and justice and environmental sustainability. Have you or the governor of Okinawa or anyone found a single Congress member or a single elected official in Japan who will take this matter up?
There are some. There are some who are sympathetic. Unfortunately, they are the minority, and they face a huge uphill battle because the administration surrounding Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, they are strongly opposed to any type of dissent. Anyone who disagrees with them, they find ways to get back at them and kind of attack them or try to censor them or try to get them to be quiet about it. So, unfortunately, politicians in Japan, including Okinawan politicians, face a huge uphill battle trying to deal with the Japanese political system under Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
Do people in Okinawa in large numbers feel that Okinawa should simply be independent of Japan, or do they identify as Japanese and want to work within that system?
This is a complicated subject because, as I said, up until 1879, Okinawa was independent. And, you know, Okinawans, you know, we have our own unique history and culture and identity and languages. But after 1879, Japan really started a heavy propaganda effort against Okinawans. Okinawans were shamed and criticized and even outlawed from using our languages and from studying our history and identifying as Okinawans. And in fact, during World War II, Japan purposely murdered a lot of the Okinawan leaders, including the independence leaders. Over 200,000 people were murdered during the Battle of Okinawa in just a few months' time. That's one-third of the Okinawan population at the time. So you can imagine that's a huge loss. That was a huge tragedy for Okinawa, and especially with a lot of the Okinawan leaders being murdered. That left a huge leadership gap in Okinawa. And even to this day, you know, we're still trying to recover. So now there are quite a few Okinawans who do support independence. Unfortunately, due to the heavy censorship and pressure from the Japanese government, a lot of them are in the closet. They're undercover. So a lot of them are afraid to publicly support independence.
Yeah.
And so this is a huge huge obstacle we're trying to face. I and others, we are trying to encourage Okinawans to express their democratic right to self-determination. But it's been a little bit of a slow process just because of all the heavy pressure there is. And but we're continuing to work on it, and I think we're going to be making some breakthroughs in the future. Yeah.
This has been an issue that people have been working on for years and years, as you know, and there's always been the anti-militarist argument. These bases are counterproductive and stir up wars rather than deterring them and so forth. But there have always been these other angles that people have tried: the destruction of coral, the destruction of the dugong, this manatee-like animal, the poisoning of groundwater with carcinogenic chemicals, the problems with drunk soldiers and rapes and crimes by U.S. occupiers. In your view, which, if any, of these angles has the most potential to accomplish anything in this effort to restrain or eliminate these bases?
Well, it's a little hard to say because different people have different opinions as to which of these is the bigger issue. So, for example, a lot of liberals or Democrats in the U.S., they find the environmental aspect to be very compelling. And, in fact, many Japanese also find that a compelling issue. So the environmental aspect has been a very useful aspect in terms of our movement. But you can imagine not everyone is interested in the environment. For example, a lot of Republicans or conservatives in the U.S. So for them, I think they've been more interested in things like cost and feasibility, necessity, security. All these are serious issues. So in my opinion, there's no one issue that stands out above the others. They're all serious, and I try to take them all equally serious. I don't want to appear to be discrediting any of them.
Sure.
So we're really just trying to share this issue as a whole with as many people as possible, and allowing others to decide, you know, which issues they can relate to the most.
Yeah. If for believers in militarism and the need for military defense and so forth, I have seen the case made that the United States would have absolutely no problem technologically at this point in completely destroying North Korea or China from California, that there isn't actually a military argument for needing all these troops and equipment in Okinawa. Is that a reasonable case to make, or is there an argument against that?
No, certainly that's a great case to make. And in fact, many U.S. military experts themselves have said that this base in particular, and in fact, many of the U.S. military bases in Okinawa are just not necessary for America's security, or for Okinawa's security, Japan's security, or the Asia-Pacific region in general. In fact, the late John McCain said this. Former Senator Jim Webb has said this. Many other U.S. politicians and military experts have said similar things, that this base is just not necessary because, this is primarily a Marine Corps base, and in the event of a conflict in Asia, the Marines would not be used.
So what are they doing there?
Yeah, so this base is really just wasting American taxpayers' money. It's causing a whole lot of problems in Okinawa. It's instigating tensions in Asia between China and the U.S. and also North Korea and the U.S. This base is posing a lot of problems, and it's not necessary at all from a military or security strategic perspective.
I remember in the information that Edward Snowden leaked out of the U.S. government that there was the revelation that the U.S. government had been sabotaging Japanese infrastructure, laying booby traps, preparing to be able to cause destruction and havoc and shutdowns in Japanese infrastructure should it ever decide that Japan was now an enemy. I wonder what the Japanese public thinks about that, if anything, and whether the idea ever occurs to anyone that the U.S. may like having bases in Japan purely to have bases in Japan as part of its plan to have bases everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. This idea of U.S. A U.S. imperial military complex worldwide is concerning, and it's not helpful for anyone, including the U.S. Now, in terms of Japanese public opinion, it varies widely. Some are more supportive of the U.S. military, but some are more against it. And in fact, our petition movement, we've gotten a lot of support from Japanese. It's hard to put a number on it, but almost half of the signatures have come from Japanese, who support Henoko and who don't want more U.S. military bases in Okinawa or Japan or anywhere.
Yeah.
I
know that at World Beyond War, we have people in Japan doing rallies and taking actions in support of Okinawa. I almost wish we had done this petition in a way that would allow us to contact those people rather than sending them to the White House website. But it was a powerful way to do it. We have about 2 minutes left. What's next? What can people do to help? How can people learn more and get involved?
So the simple way of saying this would be to just stand with Okinawa. That's kind of our motto, hashtag stand with Okinawa. We have a Facebook page. We have a website. There are a lot of people promoting this hashtag all over the internet. And if you just look up information about the Stand with Okinawa movement, you can find different ways you can help. If you haven't already, please sign the petition to the White House. Please sign and share it. There are also a few other letter writing campaigns and things like that going around that U.S. citizens can do to help Okinawa. So I would say the main thing is just look up Stand with Okinawa and get in touch with us and get in touch with other people who are part of the movement. And once you're part of it, then there are a lot of different ways U.S. citizens can help Okinawa.
We've been speaking with Rob Kajiwara. He is an Okinawan Hawaiian singer-songwriter and visual artist, and he launched this petition on the White House website that has over 200,000 or close, I think, to 200,000 signatures and should have more. I believe U.S. bases should be removed from Okinawa. Rob Kajiwara, thank you for what you're doing and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
No, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate media have been declaring organized labor moribund and sometimes abetting efforts to kill it for many years now. But more than 30,000 public school teachers in Los Angeles on strike with overwhelming community support would suggest that you ought not believe everything you read. We'll hear about the L.A. teachers' strike and competing visions for public education from Kent Wong, director of the UCLA Labor Center and vice president of the California Federation of Teachers. Also on the show, the Trump White House is trying to bring that whole breaking with democratic norms thing to the issue of Medicaid. Congress disapproved of plans to shrink the program that helps millions of children, elderly, and people with disabilities and serious health conditions. So the Trump administration reportedly wants to push through cuts by executive action. Whether or not that can happen, it's a clear sign that Medicaid remains a target. And we'll talk about what that means with Rebecca Vallis, vice president of the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress and host of the podcast Off Kilter. That's coming up, but first, a very quick look back at recent press. A president facing a major scandal, just as the highest profile trial is about to begin, pardons the indicted or convicted officials around him to effectively stop an investigation that's closing in on his own illegal conduct. Donald Trump soon? Well, we'll see. But this describes what President George H.W. Bush actually did in 1992. As Fair Associate Sam Husseini reminds on Fair.org, the Iran-Contra scandal revealed that the Reagan-Bush White House had secretly sold missiles to Iran in exchange for hostages held in Lebanon, using the proceeds to fund right-wing forces fighting the leftist Nicaraguan government in violation of U.S. law. On Christmas Eve, 1992, just as the indicted former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger was about to face trial, Bush pardoned him and five others, including former Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams and former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane. The Attorney General for Bush, who approved the pardons? William Barr, now being nominated for the same position by Trump. So is this background relevant? The Associated Press didn't seem to think so. The wire service framed its January 14th report on Barr, carried by thousands of outlets, as a stark contrast between the gentlemanly Bush and the twice-divorced Trump, and made no mention of the Iran-Contra pardons. The misleading comparison was compounded by AP describing Trump as breaking with the practice of shielding law enforcement from political influence, as if William Barr didn't have direct experience in exactly that. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. As we record on January 16th, the strike by more than 30,000 Los Angeles teachers is entering its third day. The decision to go on strike is never a whimsical one. The union, United Teachers of Los Angeles, hasn't had a strike in nearly 30 years. Coverage appears to be deepening as the labor action continues, but corporate media's initial response consisted of headlines like the New York Times's Los Angeles Teachers Strike, disrupting classes for 500,000 students. And CNN's The Los Angeles Teachers Strike may already have cost millions, and it's only day two. The sort of old-school owners offer, unions demand language that has marked media treatment of labor for decades. Here to help us see what's behind this momentous collective action by L.A. educators is Kent Wong, director of the UCLA Labor Center and vice president currently of the California Federation of Teachers. He joins us by phone from Los Angeles. Welcome to Counterspin, Kent Wong.
Thanks very much.
Well, strikes generally involve multiple issues of various scales, but they have to be enough taken together to push people to do something that involves tremendous uncertainty and that, you know, some media suggestions to the contrary, organizers are never eager to do. What should we understand about what has motivated some 98% of the union to authorize this strike?
What is remarkable about the Los Angeles teacher strike is that the main issue is not wages. The fact that 98% of the teachers of Los Angeles voted to authorize this strike reflects a deep discontent in the direction of public education here in Los Angeles, but indeed throughout the country. California public schools used to be number one in per pupil funding in the country. Now they are down there about 43rd or 44th. And they rank 48th in the nation with regard to class size. We have watched since the passage of Proposition 13 back in 1978, the steady erosion of financing for the public schools and a massive transfer of wealth from the public sector to some of the wealthiest corporate landowners in the state of California. The second big issue is that there has been a hemorrhaging of resources from the public schools by the corporate-backed for-profit education system and the network of charter schools that have developed throughout Los Angeles. And during the last school board election, corporate-backed candidates swept the majority now on the school board who support the continued privatization of public schools.
Well, this is the bigger picture, and I want to go back to that. But when you just read coverage, you hear, well, it's about class size. The union says they want class sizes to be smaller, which you noted. But then they say, well, the district says they just don't have the money for that. The money just doesn't exist to do that. That's kind of the granular issue that one sees in media coverage with then perhaps some allusion to this bigger picture question about visions. But if I could ask you, how are we to interpret the sort of day-to-day coverage that says, well, it's about the fact that the unions want funding that just doesn't exist?
California is the fifth largest economy in the world. The reality is that there is a $2 billion reserve within the LA Unified School District currently, and the superintendent that was hired by the charter-backed majority on the school board is a hedge fund multimillionaire who knows nothing about public education. So this is really a question of a fight for quality public education and a pushback against corporate-dominated policies, which are calling for the transference of wealth, the public sector, to the for-profit private education world, where there are no regulations, where corporations are making money off the education of our children.
Yeah, I think we have to have some question when folks are celebrated for not having a background in education, you know, as though public education is an area where you really want someone whose credential is being a disruptor. I would note what Leonie Hamson wrote in the Washington Post, which was Arne Duncan, who recently had an op-ed against former Education Secretary Arne Duncan, who opposed the LA teacher strike. You know, his kids aren't in schools with classes the size of the classes in, you know, on average in Los Angeles. So a lot of these folks who are putting forward other or who are critical of public education,
their kids are not in these schools, and it matters. You know, Aaliyah Wong wrote a piece in The Atlantic where she was interviewing striking workers, many of them Latino, in Los Angeles, and they weren't even talking about Boitner, you know, or some of them weren't even talking about charters. They were really just talking about how they want something better for the kids that they teach.
Absolutely. And in Los Angeles, as in major cities throughout the country, there are major class and racial divides. 70% of the children in the public schools of Los Angeles are Latino, and there are large numbers of Asian and African-American students as well in the public schools. And increasingly, we see a situation where those with financial resources are choosing to put their children in private schools. So we have a public disinvestment policy with regard to public schools that is being led by corporate America, but that has certain support from those that have wealth and privilege in this country who can pay for other alternatives. So this is really a broader issue of civil and human rights. In the fifth largest economy in the world, it is a disgrace that our public schools are so poorly funded, and it has a disproportionate impact on low-income children and their families and students of color.
Right. And so coverage that sort of presents it as teachers versus students, I find just so invidious and so harmful when, you know, when you talk to these teachers, they're thinking of their students first.
Absolutely. The public support for the teachers of Los Angeles has been remarkable. The teachers have really emerged as heroes within this fight. They are challenging the status quo. They are fighting for a future for their children. These are teachers who are used to using their own money to pay for basic supplies and basic needs in the classroom. These are teachers who work many hours after the classroom in order to provide the support needed for their children. And they're putting up a good fight. And what's been very gratifying is to watch the broad public support that our teachers are enjoying right here in Los Angeles.
I spoke with labor reporter Mike Elk of Payday Report many months ago, talking about the teacher strike in West Virginia. And he was saying that we hear a lot about how unions are going under and, you know, they don't have any meaning in the society anymore. But that in the South, for example, you have unions that don't have collective bargaining rights. They're even in right-to-work states, and they're still winning victories. I've heard you also say that a drop-off in unionization, per se, doesn't necessarily mean that workers aren't organized. But what's happening in L.A. disputes that negativity in a number of ways, doesn't it?
Well, what is very dramatic is that the United Teachers of Los Angeles is affiliated with the largest union in the country, the National Education Association, as well as the American Federation of Teachers, one of the largest unions in the country. And the largest single group of organized workers in the country today are teachers. So the fact that we have such amazing solidarity among the teachers here in Los Angeles is a really powerful statement about the relevance and importance of unions in the fight not only for the rights of workers, but in the broader fight for quality public education.
And their ability to build partnerships with the community is what, when it comes that you have to go on a strike, that's how you can have a community supporting you in that action.
The fact that 500,000 children are impacted by this strike, and the fact that the parents and the community at large are standing with the teachers, is really a wake-up call in terms of what we need to do collectively to demand quality public education.
We've been speaking with Kent Wong, director of the UCLA Labor Center and currently vice president of the California Federation of Teachers. Kent Wong, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
Recent reporting by Politico, citing three administration sources, says that the Trump White House, having failed to get congressional support for the capping and shrinking of federal Medicaid spending, now plans to try to make those changes without congressional approval. Cutbacks to the low-income health program that helps some 75 million people, people with disabilities, children, seniors, they've long been a GOP goal.
but every time it comes up, it's been soundly rebuffed by a range of advocates for people who rely on the program. Clearly, that vigilance is still required, and our next guest has been tracking the issue. Rebecca Vallis is the vice president of the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress and the host of the podcast Off Kilter. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Rebecca Vallis.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Well, this is a disturbing new tactic, trying to ram through the dismantling of Medicaid by some sort of executive action. But proponents of that dismantling, which now include Seema Verma, administrator of what's called the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Service, their argument, or the one they say out loud anyway, seems basically unchanged. So maybe we should start with addressing the idea that folks will have seen in media coverage that capping federal Medicaid spending, converting it to block grants, would give states more flexibility in how they administer the program.
So, Janine, I'm really appreciative that you started there because I feel like block grant is one of those jargon terms that gets thrown around in the halls of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., but it needs to be decoded a little bit for folks to really take it and understand what it means in English. So block grant is code for converting a program from one that guarantees coverage to everyone who qualifies, that is currently the way that Medicaid works, to a program that helps fewer and fewer eligible people over time because it involves capping that program's funding in a way that declines year after year. So currently, Medicaid is it's a federal state program. That means it's partially funded by the feds. It's partially funded by the states. The feds pick up a set percentage of states' Medicaid costs. And what a block grant would do to the Medicaid program is to cap the amount of federal funds that states get, giving them a fixed dollar amount, and then requiring them to pick up the rest. So effectively, block granting is a backdoor strategy for making really, really deep cuts to a program, and in this case, Medicaid, in a way that's intentionally designed to make those cuts grow deeper every single year. And your listeners will not be surprised to hear that what that means in the case of Medicaid is lots and lots of people losing their health insurance.
And there's research on this. This is not speculation. We know how what block grants actually turn out to mean when they're put into place.
That's exactly right. And this is definitely not a new idea, as you said. I mean, it goes all the way back to former Speaker Paul Ryan's kegger days. He told us that one of his dreams in Congress was to dismantle Medicaid by block granting it. But analysis of a recent proposal similar to this that House Republicans had included as part of the recent health care fight, where they were trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but also trying to dismantle Medicaid. That was a big part of that fight, too. Analysis of a proposal that Republicans had put forth to block grant Medicaid, and this comes to us from the Urban Institute, it estimated that between 14 million and 21 million Americans would have lost Medicaid if that proposal had taken effect. So that is the kind of policy that we're watching this White House continue to try to champion, despite the fact that the American people stood up and loudly rejected the White House's and Republicans in Congress's attempt to take health insurance away from tens of millions of Americans, including through their attempts that failed to dismantle Medicaid through legislation. And part of the reason I'm connecting the current proposal from this administration to the health care fight of 2017 and to some extent 2018 is because this is exactly the kind of playbook we have seen this White House take to. When Trump doesn't get his cruel agenda through Congress, he turns around and takes matters into his own hands and tries to see how much damage he can do to programs that help low-income folks like Medicaid by fiat. So that's what he's doing here. He's trying to sidestep Congress and take health insurance away from potentially tens of millions of Americans unilaterally.
I interviewed ADAPT organizer, disability rights organizer Mike Irvin in 2011 when 91 protesters, many of them in wheelchairs, had been arrested on Capitol Hill
protesting another assault on Medicaid, Paul Ryan, as you're referring to, and Mike Irvin's response to the idea that block grants give states flexibility was to say that's like saying Jim Crow laws give states more flexibility to decide who gets to drink at their water fountains. You know, flexibility is basically a code word for abandonment. And people with disabilities would be especially hard hit or impacted by these sorts of changes, wouldn't they?
That's exactly right. People with disabilities are really one of the groups who would be hurt the most if Medicaid were dismantled by a block grant proposal like this. And that's because for many people with disabilities and folks with severe health conditions, Medicaid isn't just health insurance. It's also home and community-based services. I'm talking here about personal attendant care, skilled nursing, the kind of stuff that makes it possible for millions of people with disabilities to live independently, to remain in their homes instead of being forced into institutions to receive the kinds of care and services that they need. So loss of Medicaid would push people with disabilities potentially into institutions in droves, but it would also, and this is sort of a secondary point that doesn't get a lot of attention in the healthcare context, loss of Medicaid would also push lots of people with disabilities out of the workforce. And that's because those home and community-based services I was just talking about don't just enable people with disabilities to live independently in many cases, but also to work outside the home. And that's really what's at stake here for folks with disabilities, not just loss of needed care that allows them to remain healthy, but also independence at its core.
That was one of the points that you made in a very well-received and useful Twitter thread. And I thought it really struck me because it just adds additional weirdness to the fact that people continue to trot out this line that public assistance is about lulling people into laziness and so on. And we're really talking about a change that would have the effect of making it impossible for some people to work in the way that they have been doing.
And that's not just true for people with disabilities and severe health conditions. We've also seen now a growing body of research telling us that Medicaid expansion is actually a huge pro-work strategy, because when people are healthier, maybe this doesn't come as quite a shock to your listeners, but when people are healthier, they're better able to work. They have higher earnings. They have higher labor force participation. So this administration has really been doing everything it can to try to dress up its cruel cut agenda with puppies and rainbows language that makes it sound like it's all in service of work. But this is actually a massively counterproductive strategy if the goal is actually work, and we know it's not.
You also note in that thread that it isn't only people who lose insurance who can be harmed, because states that are pushed to cut costs will find other ways to do that, like throwing up hoops or making it harder to get medicines and services. But for those who could and would lose insurance, that means we should really think about harms up to and including death, including people dying, right?
Now, Republicans in Congress really don't like when people make the point that you just made about how when you take health care away from people, people die and lives are literally on the line. But that's not histrionic. That's reality, unfortunately, here. And as a result, back during the healthcare fight in 2017, some folks took to calling Medicaid cuts like block grants the real death panels. I'm going to put some numbers to this for anyone who thinks that that's overblown or histrionic, like some of the proponents of these cuts have claimed that they are. The Congressional Budget Office back in 2017, taking a look at some of those Republican health care repeal plans, they estimated that more than 200,000 so-called unnecessary deaths, literally people dying who otherwise would not have, would occur by 2026 if the Senate Republican health care repeal plan had taken health insurance away from tens of millions of Americans, as it would have. So that's what's at stake here, is literally people's lives that are on the line if this kind of a policy policy takes effect. But on the flip side of the coin, we know that expanding Medicaid actually saves lives. And some analysis from the Center for American Progress finds that if all of the states, the 14 states that still are refusing to adopt Medicaid expansion, did expand the program, we would save over 100,000 lives just over the coming decade. So we know what to do from a policy perspective if what we're trying to do is to make sure we have a healthy population and workforce. But this agenda that is still being pursued by the Trump administration to take health insurance away from as many people as possible, even without the blessing of Congress, now that they've failed to get it, it literally is an agenda that will kill people.
Well, let me just say finally, as you've noted, the people have spoken on this, you know, repeatedly. They want no part of it. They prefer Medicaid to expand rather than shrink. You know, I mean, go figure. You know, folks just aren't in favor of cutting the safety net. But what about the politics? Bob Casey, the Democratic senator, has said hell no to this whole idea of, you know, changing Medicaid by fiat. I see Representative Frank Pallone from Jersey says that CMS doesn't have the legal authority to block grant Medicaid. What's your sense of what the administration has the power to do here and what can we do?
You are exactly right that legal advocates wasted no time in taking a look at this and voicing their very strong read that Trump does not have the legal authority to block grant Medicaid through administrative action. This is something that would take an act of Congress. So lawsuits are inevitably going to follow if the administration does move forward with this plan. And at the same time, the newly Democratic-controlled House will for sure try to block this cruel move. House Democrats have already vowed to investigate the Trump administration's healthcare sabotage. This is part and parcel of that ongoing sabotage effort. And as you said, Senate Democrats as well, even though they're not in control of that chamber, will be important voices in this debate as well. But I want to just leave people with the note that even though we're still waiting to see where things go from here, what exactly the proposal looks like out of this administration, it wouldn't hurt to call your member of Congress and let them know what you think, especially now that House Democrats are poised to be a check on Trump. And we know where the American people stand on this. Polling by the Center for American Progress last year found that 80% of Americans oppose cutting Medicaid. The American people loudly and clearly said no when Republicans in Congress and the Trump administration tried to dismantle this popular program as part of their health care repeal efforts. And that is exactly why we're seeing the Trump administration try to go around Congress and do this unilaterally, because they know it's not something that the American people would allow to happen if it were done in the light of day.
We've been speaking with Rebecca Vallis, Vice President of the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress, host of the podcast Off Kilter. She's on Twitter at Rebecca Vallis. Rebecca Vallis, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
While Washington spins, here is the real alert. We may be in a rapid shift of warming on Earth. It is very serious. Australia has been hit with yet another summer from hell. The government warns citizens to stay inside as temperatures went over 45 degrees C, 113 degrees Fahrenheit, in parts of New South Wales, South Australia, and Victoria. As reported in the Big Wobble blog, in the South Australian town of Port Augusta, temperatures hit 48.5 degrees C on Tuesday, the highest since records began in 1962. That's about 122 degrees Fahrenheit. According to the country's Meteorological Bureau, the past 4 days are among Australia's top 10 warmest day on records. It's cooking down there. Bats and birds are dropping dead out of the sky from the heat. Millions of fish died, crops are damaged, and more humans will die from heat.
And people tend not to recognize it. In a place like Australia, some of the responses we're getting from people we interview is that, look, it's just summer, get over it. You know, don't be wussy. You know, you can keep going, just, you know, soldier on. And I think this is where we need to change our mindset in the fact that recognise that heat can kill and is killing people. In fact, it's already killing more people than the road death. And heat has killed more people in Australia than any other natural hazard ever.
Here in the Pacific Northwest, December was 3 degrees C, over 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal day and night. It hardly went below freezing. The U.S. South and East have been battered by storm after storm, as has California. The polar vortex split, spattering bitter cold into pockets around the world. We are in climate disarray. I am on the phone with scientists trying to find out why things are jumping instead of ramping up more slowly. Last week, I covered new science titled Global Warming Will Happen Faster Than We Think. Grab that from my website at ecoshock.org if you missed it. This week, I talk with the lead author of that paper, Yang Shu. We zero in on the way a cleanup of air pollution, particularly in China, may be now revealing hidden heat built up over decades of fossil fuel emissions. Later in this program, we will explore the way warming makes big droughts worse with scientist Julio Herrera Estrada. But first, we get a briefing from Eric Rigno, senior research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab and one of the top ice experts in the world. Eric has more staggering news, this time from Antarctica.
Radio EcoShock.
Here is the latest shocking headline in this age of climate change. Antarctica losing 6 times more ice mass annually now than 40 years ago. To explain the breaking science, we are joined by Dr. Eric Rigno, Chair of Earth System Science at University of California, Irvine, and Senior Research Scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Eric Rigno, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Just 10 years ago, we were told, don't worry about Antarctica. Sea ice there was actually expanding. We thought snow was piling up deeper in the interior of the continent. How did we get from there to your new results published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences?
Well, sort of 10 years ago, we had already indications that some significant changes were taking place in the Antarctic. I think the light turned on about this about the mid-1990s, but it took more time to collect more data and understand what we were seeing better in order to come to a firmer conclusion. What you mentioned in terms of snowfall accumulation in the interior relates to old climate models that represented Antarctica as a sort of a sluggish mass only responding to change in snowfall, which were predicted to increase because of increased evaporation of the surrounding warmer ocean. What we found in the last 20-plus years is that the glaciers draining the ice from the Antarctic continent are responding to climate forcing. They're responding in a stronger way and in a slightly different way than what was anticipated.
And in 2014, you and your team said that some of the melting in a section of West Antarctic ice sheet was, quote, unstoppable. Can we now say that about other parts of Antarctica?
I think one of the highlights of this study is that there are other parts of Antarctica, especially in East Antarctica, that seem to be vulnerable and are changing slowly right now and potentially hold more sea level rise potential than the West Antarctic part that is slowly falling apart right now. So it's sort of suggesting that more of the Antarctic continent is at stake than what we thought some years ago.
At the other pole of the Earth, Eric, the Arctic has been abnormally, unbelievably hotter. Has the same thing happened in Antarctica, and is that the cause of the increasing rate of ice loss there?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. Both Greenland and Antarctica are actually mostly reacting to a change in ocean heat along the periphery of the island or the continent. In addition, in Greenland, of course, we have very warm air temperature that increased the melt of the ice sheet. In the Antarctic, the air temperature has not risen to the point where we melt the snow and ice. And in fact, Antarctica as a whole has not been warming up as fast as the rest of the world, whereas Greenland has been warming at 2 to 3 times the rest of the world. So situations are a little bit different, but the processes that are conducive to the disappearance of the land ice are similar. They are related to more warm ocean waters in contact with the ice sheet. So I could explain to you a little bit what's happening in the Antarctic if you're interested.
I'm very interested. Please do.
So what's happening in the Antarctic is that the wind regime around the Antarctic, the westerlies that circulate clockwise around the Antarctic, if you're looking at South Pole, have increased in strength over time and markedly since the 1980s. They do that because Antarctica has not been warming up as fast as the rest of the world. So the temperature difference between Antarctica and the warming world has increased, and that results in stronger winds circulating around the continent. So not only these winds are getting stronger, they're contracting towards South Pole. And as a result of the Coriolis force, these winds tend to push the surface waters to the north, which in part explains the slight expanse of the sea ice. And to compensate for that, they push the subsurface waters to the south. And in the polar regions, the heat is not at the surface, it's below the surface, several hundred meters, where the water is warmer and saltier. That's why it's stable there. And that salty and warm water is able to melt the glaciers around the Antarctic much faster than it did in the past. And that is conducive to the glaciers accelerating into the sea because they feel less resistance to flow when they come to the coastline. Some of the plugs in front of them have been removed by the ocean, and they are able to flow slightly faster.
And your paper mentions the ozone hole as a contributing factor. Why is that?
Yes, strangely, the ozone is also a participant. The disappearance of the ozone layer is resulting in a cooling of the stratosphere in the Antarctic because you don't have as much interaction between the ozone and incoming UV radiations from the sun. So that contributes also to the fact that the Antarctic is not warming up as fast as the rest of the world. Another factor that we should not forget about is that the snow fields, the snow cover in the Arctic is reducing very rapidly. The sea ice, as we know, has been reduced in a spectacular fashion. So as a result, we're replacing a very highly reflective surface in the Arctic by something that absorbs the solar radiation more. And as a result, the Arctic is warming a lot faster than the rest of the world. In the Antarctic, we don't have that. The Antarctic continent is almost as vast as before. The snow is not melting. The sea ice has not been retreating very rapidly. So in terms of the radiation budget, how much heat is absorbed by the Antarctic from the sun, there's been very little change compared to what's happening in the Arctic.
We don't get a lot of news from Antarctica, but when we do, it's often about huge ice shelves falling off West Antarctica, like the Larsen B many, many years ago. Are those really important events?
Yeah, they are very significant events, especially the Larsen B event that you mentioned, because prior to this event, there was still a little bit of debate in the community as to whether these floating extension played any role in buttressing, in holding back all the land ice from the Antarctic from spilling out into the ocean. So when we saw the breakup of Larsen B, we looked at the glaciers upstream of that ice shelf to figure out whether they would speed up or not. And not only they sped up, they accelerated by a factor 3 to 8 in a very short term period. And we are now 17 years later, and these glaciers are still flowing 3 to 5 times above their prior speed, which shows that the change in that part of Antarctica was irreversible and unstoppable.
So West Antarctica is the sort of point that heads up towards Chile and Argentina, but the large part of the continent is East Antarctica. Have you more to report in this new paper about that part of the South Pole?
Yeah, so the traditional view on East Antarctica, which is, as you said, the largest share of the Antarctic continent, is that it sits higher. It's higher in elevation. It sits on bedrock that, for the most part, is above sea level, whereas West Antarctica is grounded on bedrock below sea level. That's why we call it a marine ice sheet. So the prevailing view on East Antarctica is that it's not vulnerable to change. It's as cold as can be, and nothing can perturb it. Most of the changes that we see in East Antarctica, however, are along the coastline. And as I said earlier, the surrounding ocean plays a very important role in the evolution of these glaciers. And they are the sort of knobs that control how much of that ice in the East Antarctic plateau is able to spill out to the Southern Ocean. And we found that these knobs have a few leaks in them.
And after an exhaustive survey, you found in the 1990s, ice loss from Antarctica more than tripled from the previous decade, and it's gone up again every decade since. Is there a way to predict that rate of loss for the next few decades?
Well, that's sort of the ultimate goal of all these studies, besides detailing exactly what's happening to the polar regions and understanding the physical processes that control the evolution of the ice. We want to put that new knowledge, new understanding of the evolution of the ice into numerical models, sophisticated numerical models that include not only the ice, but the surrounding ocean, the atmosphere, the winds, so that we can make a more reliable projection of sea level in the future. So right now, the projection that we have I would call rather primitive because they don't include all the key components, and they are also conservative because they do not represent the vector of very rapid changes in the Antarctic, which are the glaciers. And most of what we're seeing today says that the glaciers are the vector of the mass change in the Antarctic. So until we have a very reliable description of what they do in these models, the projection of sea level rise from the Antarctic in the future should be called into question and be considered as conservative as to what may happen in the future. Now, as glaciologists, we don't want to tell the public what a conservative scenario might be. We would like to be able to inform them about the worst-case scenario, because in the case of sea level, you just want to know how bad things can be rather than some middle range raise of sea level.
And do you have a guesstimate on what that might be by the year 2100? How much will we get?
Well, we are right now, if we look at the rate of increase of the mass loss from Greenland, from Antarctica, and from all the mountain glaciers around the world, and if we add up the thermal expansion from the ocean, we are on a pace that is going to take us to 1 meter sea level rise by 2100. It is likely that the pace of decay of the polar regions will probably get higher than that. We've only seen sort of the beginning of the decay of the polar regions. But that also depends on what we do with our climate system. Not the whole history of the 21st century is written in stone yet. The next 20, 30 years are probably written in stone. But what's going to happen after that depends also on how we control climate warming.
Eric, what will you be working on next?
We continue our work in Greenland. I think my main focus in the coming years is to gather more data around the Antarctic and especially in East Antarctica so we can make timely and solid progress in constraining the evolution of this part of Antarctica so we can put that knowledge in models and improve the reliability of these models at projecting what's going to happen in the coming decades. This way, the public and policymakers will have more solid data in hand to make the right decision for our future. In the meantime, I'm still keen to convey the information we gather from satellites and airborne platforms and other means to the general public so that they stay informed of what's going on right now and hopefully appreciate that we have a serious problem in the polar regions that's going to affect all of us.
Well, I'll put some links to this new science and more about how to find out what NASA is discovering in our weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. We have been talking with Dr. Eric Regnault, head of the Earth Sciences at University of California, Irvine, and senior research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. Eric, thank you so much for this briefing.
You're most welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You have seen pictures of crowds in Chinese cities with masks over their faces. The smog of rapid industrialization is thick, but Chinese authorities are working overtime to clear the air. But will air pollution get better or worse in a hotter world? Could cleaner air actually heat the planet? It's difficult to get the latest on the situation in China, but we have reached one of the best young scientists working on it. Dr. Yangyang Xu was educated in Beijing. He came to America to study with the legendary Ram Ramanathan at the Scripps Institution in San Diego. Now Yangyang is an assistant professor at Texas A&M University. He has already published 30 papers, with more in the works. Yangyang Xu, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Hi, everyone.
I want to begin by saying this discussion is not against China. I mean, air pollution is a problem well known in many countries, and Chinese authorities, as I say, are struggling to resolve it quickly without damaging the economy, and this science is part of that. So let's start with some basics. We know what the global average for carbon dioxide pollution is in any year. Is there a similar global count for aerosols, or is that pollution so regional that a global number is not helpful?
You're actually very right on this. CO2 measurement is easier to take because CO2 has a much longer lifetime. So any places, if you take measurement of CO2 concentration, it won't be very different. But the aerosol is exactly the different. It has much shorter lifetime. So region to region, the concentration can vary by many orders of magnitudes. So you have to be taking very local measurement to get accurate numbers. There has been a lot of effort into this, especially in developing countries such as China and India, to build intensive network of air pollution measurement, both for particulate matters, the hazy picture you have pointed out, and also the gas components. We have much better understanding of this problem than 5 or 10 years ago.
On this program, we had an expert tell us that some of the snowmelt in Colorado was happening earlier because of soot that was arriving from Asia. Can it really travel that far?
Oh, yeah. When I say the shorter lifetime, I really mean 5 to 10 days. So if there's a right storm track system during that time frame, it can well carry as well as the dust emission from Asian desert all the way across Pacific into Western United States and also Canada. So that has been documented in many studies from satellite images, and also we can use numerical models to tease out the exact pathway of those transport. And the downstream effect to the mountain snow melting is, of course, less clear, but there are also emerging evidence suggesting when those soots get deposited over bright snow. Remember, soots are very black. So once they get removed from the atmosphere and deposited over snow, it will darken the snow surface and make the snow melting faster and earlier in the season. And I have published papers on this problem, but for Himalaya regions, which is more prone to local air pollution issues from both South Asia and East Asia portion. And we have well documented the long-term snow retreating trend in the last 30 to 50 years is partially coming from greenhouse gas warming globally, but also from the regional air pollution issues. And the relative contribution is almost the same.
Now, in a series of papers, you and your colleagues have investigated the behavior of air pollution in a warming world, and some of what you found is not what I expected. Could you describe those relationships between a hotter planet and the smog that we produce?
Yeah, there are two issues here, which is wrapped into the problem of the interaction of global warming and air pollution. By interaction, I mean air pollution can lead to less or more global warming. And the second half of this problem is global warming can also intensify or reduce air pollution. So let me explain the first part. We have all known the dominant cause of the global warming is from greenhouse gas emissions. But at the same time, those chimneys producing greenhouse gas are also emitting air pollution, such as particles. And most of the particles are reflecting solar radiation back to the space and therefore cooling the planet. So those are exactly offsetting the global warming effect. But of course, overall, global greenhouse gas warming is larger. That's why we have observed long-term warming trend in the past century. But the problem is, we could have experienced much more warming if we have not produced air pollution problem along the way, which means part of the global warming has been temporarily masked by air pollution from certain countries. But looking into the future, that trend will be well reversed due to the issues you have touched on, the health concerns, the visibility concerns in those regions, and the countries are taking fast actions to solve those issues. So if the air pollution problem will be quickly resolved in the next 20 or 30 years, that will contribute to a net warming instead of a cooling in the past. And that net warming will add on to any additional greenhouse gas warming. So that will bring us a much difficult problem to deal with in terms of adapting to climate change problem at a local scales. So that's the first part. I can explain more on the second part, but if you have question about the first half, I can further elaborate.
No, I think that we have talked about that on the program, how global dimming, as it were, can cool the planet, and we could be in trouble if we actually clean up all the air. We could go, I've heard figures from half a degree to 0.7 degrees warmer if the air was actually clean. And we'll talk more about that as we go along. But I am interested in the second part. For example, in January 2019, you co-authored a paper predicting worse pollution for East China due to increased greenhouse gases. So I'm left with the question, how can haze get worse even as the government tries to clean the air up?
Yes, let me explain on that. This is a trickier question, actually a very concerning one, in my personal opinion, which is global warming can actually make air pollution issues worse by itself. So we all know the air pollution issue is coming from large emission, dirty emission, but also it's governed by meteorological conditions. Certain meteorological conditions can keep the particle emission longer in the atmosphere and make the concentration higher. which is affecting human health. But certain weather conditions, such as heavy rainfall or stronger wind, those can help remove the air pollution or dispersing air pollution to a different region, so help the local air pollution problem. What we have been studied using global climate model is the future global warming, mostly coming from greenhouse gas, will actually make the meteorological condition worse to remove air pollution from the atmosphere. This meteorological factor is working against local action to cut emission. I'm not saying the local emission is not working. I'm just saying the meteorological condition is doing the opposite to the emission cut, which actually means you need to cut more than you have planned to reach certain air quality goals than what you have expected, because global warming will not help you in this regard.
So I'm just going from memory here, but I recall a talk in a video in the early 2000s by Ram Ramanathan, and I believe he said that evaporation of water from pans, a really old way of measuring the amount of sunlight reaching the earth, it showed a decline of about 9% in the amount of sunlight reaching the ground in eastern China. Does that match up with later research that you've done?
The long-term dimming trend due to air pollution will definitely cause a local evaporation reduction, but at the same time, global warming will cause ocean warming and the surface evaporation enhancement. So those two factors are competing, and it's unclear which one will win eventually. But so far from now, I have not looked at the observational record over China closely to have the updated numbers. What we have been argued to explain the global warming effect on air pollution is overall the evaporation and the precipitation will increase because of the global warming, but that precipitation increase will mostly concentrated in certain days, which makes the heavy rainfall heavier. The so-called when it rains, it will pour. But we will at the same time have longer days that has no rainfall. So even though the total rainfall will increase, we will have longer days with little or light rainfall days. And those days are exactly the days you will experience more air pollution if the emissions are the same. So that was the mechanism we use to explain our hypothesis that global warming will lead to heavier pollutions.
Yang, have we seen a significant reduction in aerosols over China? Do we have measurements to show that this is actually happening?
If we look at China locally, especially the northern China, there has been local measurements showing after 2013, the air pollution level is actually going down. And that is likely due to the local regulation and strong actions on this. If we only see air pollution level going down in 1 year, maybe that's just due to the year-to-year variability of meteorology. But once we have seen more than 5 years, a relatively longer trend of decline, people have done model experiment to suggest that cannot be explained by meteorology alone, and that has to be due to the local regulations. So in that sense, that has been very encouraging that the local government are doing the right thing and the action is now paying off. But in terms of global warming, that's not a very good news. Remember, the quicker reduction of air pollution will actually lead to more global warming, and those numbers are currently underestimated in even the latest IPCC reports, which are based on the earlier projection for the future. But now newer numbers are showing government are doing a faster and better job in cleaning up the air.
So are your research results specific to China, or can we apply these lessons in any country with air pollution, or does the work have to be redone, say, for North America or for Europe?
The general methodology can be easily transferred to any places. I have also done work related to South Asia, using similar methodology because it is very unclear whether they will repeat the pathway of development like East Asia or they will take a cleaner pathway. If India is repeating the pathway of East Asia development, then their emission will go up and go down in the future. If they are alternatively taking a clean pathway, then we will actually see quicker warming due to the less pollution over South Asia. For North America and Europe, it's less a problem. The haze problem is not as severe as in Asian countries, but there are also problems at city level. In terms of research tools, people have developed numerical models specifically targeting urban environment using very high resolution modeling tools so they can provide prescription to local problems.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. With me is Dr. Yang-Yang Shu from Texas A&M University. We are talking about how air pollution changes in a warming world, with China mainly as our case study. Yang-Yang, would you talk to us about the relationship between air pollution and extreme rainfall events, say in the past 30 years, and then what is expected in the future?
Yes, we had a new study exactly on this topic. This is a very difficult problem because it is very unclear about the relationship between aerosol and the extreme rainfall. There are basically some competing factors going on. Some people have suggested aerosol will trigger the convective rainfall, which is leading to the most extreme form of precipitation, therefore playing an enhancement in the flooding event. But our study have also suggested aerosol can lead to surface cooling, and that reduce the water vapor evaporation from the ocean, and therefore reduce the tendency to have heavier rainfall. This is a very important question because the public will remember those extreme events, not global mean temperature or even regional mean climatology conditions, and how to predict and attribute the extreme event is an ongoing effort for climate scientists overall. And our contribution here is to suggest the long-term observed record of extreme rainfall trend, which is a very heterogeneous distribution regionally. We have drying in South Asia, the wetting in South China, and the drying in North China. This highly heterogeneous spatial pattern can only explain by the aerosol forcing in the last 30 years, which is vastly increasing. And we cannot explain this spatial pattern if we only look at the global warming simulation or looking at the natural variability itself.
Does smog or haze cool the nearby oceans, and is that significant?
Yes, that was exactly the mechanism we proposed to explain the long-term rainfall trend. Because of the solar radiation reduction, the air pollution overall will cool the ocean surface and reduce the moisture transport from the ocean into the continent, which is the source of water vapor producing heavy rainfall. This is happening for South Asia as well as East Asia.
We recently learned from a German database that China is either building or financing new coal plants in many countries, including in their Belt and Road project. How critical are coal emissions specifically to the overall load of aerosols in the air?
Coal emission is a major source of SO2 or sulfur emission for China. So that's a very dirty source of energy. However, we can also see there is an inertia going on in energy infrastructure, even though we have clear evidence of coal emission will lead to air pollution and also health issues. But the energy sectors are keep doing that, not only in China, there are also recent proposals even in North Europe to build new coal power plant. So that's very depressing, I can say that.
Yes. Getting back to the point that you raised about extreme precipitation events, the IPCC released a special report saying that there would be more extreme precipitation events as the world heats up. I was wondering if that extra rain, would it wash out even more pollution or not?
Yes, this is getting back to the conversation we had early on about why global warming can actually make air pollution worse. This is a bit counterintuitive because global warming will have more water vapor available and therefore more rainfall. So intuitively, more rainfall will lead to a more effective wet removal and therefore a cleaner atmosphere. But our modeling studies last year have shown the opposite. As I have explained early, the total rainfall increase will mainly occur in certain heavier rainfall days. The other days with less rainfall or light rainfall will actually become more frequent. So in those days, air pollution will be very easy to build up in the atmosphere. So if you look at the long-term average, it is exactly the opposite. The rainfall increase overall will actually lead to a smaller efficiency of wet removal and therefore heavier pollution problem.
Life is strange. Okay, now in the winters of 2013, 2015, and 2016, China experienced something like smog storms, we could call it. An industry had to be shut down, car traffic was slashed. How do those air quality emergencies develop, and do you expect them to continue appearing in the future?
Yeah, if you look at the individual hazy episode, that has been due to both the emission from the local sources as well as certain meteorological conditions that are favorable of keeping the pollution locally instead of spreading it out to the Pacific Ocean. I haven't done any detailed studies on that, but my speculation is those events will continue in the next 5 to 10 years. And the longer beyond that, the local regulation will pay off and we will see those events going down.
As you know, some parts of the Earth are heating up more than others. For example, the Arctic is warming faster than North America generally. And an Indian expert on Radio EcoShock told us India is already 1.5 degrees warmer over most of the country for most of the year. Now, China is a large land mass, and it has several subregions. Is the forecast for heating over China different than global average figures?
Yeah, for sure. Global numbers is not universally true for everywhere. As you mentioned, certain regions are more sensitive to global warming, such as polar regions. China overall, the warming numbers so far and the future projection is not very different from global numbers because it's in the mid-latitude region that has a large domain. But certain regions in China, such as the plateau regions in Tibet, is known to be very sensitive to global warming because of the elevation. And this has a lot of downstream effects for river hydrology and fresh water.
It would be ironic if humans stopped polluting the air with our sun-reflecting sulfates, but then we feel forced to spray more sulfates in the Arctic or in the stratosphere to cool the planet back down. Do you think geoengineering will be necessary?
I would see that as a potential option that we can deploy if that's the only thing we're left. But this will be an emergency option. So far, there are only numerical modeling work to demonstrate the efficiency and the potential negative consequence of those so-called geoengineering schemes. There are no large-scale in-situ experiment to test out any of this. So, yeah, I would see that as a last resort.
Yang Shu, what motivated you as a student to become an atmospheric scientist?
Oh, that's a good question. I studied physics when I was an undergraduate student, and later on, I want to do something more related to the real world and also potentially benefiting the society. that's what motivated me to switch to atmospheric and the climate sciences. And I'm very happy about that. And I'm working hard daily to pursue that goal.
You must be, for the number of papers you put out. It's hard to imagine how you have a life. You work so hard. But as we finish up here, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I really appreciate the opportunities to speak through your program to the listeners. I would see without public support, none of the climate research can be conducted. And also without public support, all the scientific results are not really useful. It has to be through communication to the public and also the further communication through public.
I totally agree. From Texas A&M University, we have been talking with Dr. Yang Yang Xu. He is the lead author in the new paper, Global Warming Will Happen Faster Than We Think, as published in the journal Nature. He is an expert in the relationships between air pollution in China and climate change. Find links to the science in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Yang Yang, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Radio EcoShock.
Terrible droughts driven by climate change can increase greenhouse gas emissions in a way you wouldn't expect. When the reservoirs at electric power dams run low, utilities make up the difference by burning more fossil fuels. In a new case study of the American West, the extra emissions are significant. This is just one part of the big story emerging as the world warms. Our guest is a drought specialist from Stanford University's Department of Earth Systems Science. Julio Herrera Estrada is a postdoctoral scholar with published research on droughts in Mexico, the United States, and Africa. Julio, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about your recent paper, Response of Electricity Sector Air Pollution Emissions to Drought Conditions in the Western United States. That was published December 21st, 2018, in Environmental Research Letters. First of all, how do CO2 emissions from the electricity sector figure in the overall total of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, say compared to cars or all the other uses we have?
In the U.S., the power sector produces around a third of the total emissions from all the sectors. Globally, this number is, I think, closer to a quarter, so 25% of all emissions, as best as we understand it, tend to come from the power sector.
So it really matters what happens in that sector. And Julio, what happens when giant power dams lose water capacity during a drought?
So we find that when we have less capacity of hydropower, for example, and even all the power plants as well, like natural gas and nuclear, because of a drought, you see an increase in generation with natural gas and coal. And the point is that in the U.S. especially, you know, people want to make sure that when they turn on the switch, like the light will turn on. Right. And so in order to have that level of reliability, there needs to be a lot of backup generation. And here, the backup generation is coal and natural gas, depending on the state. So again, when hydropower runs dry or nuclear power decreases or other type of electricity generation is affected by a drought, natural gas or coal power plants will come online to make sure that electricity keeps flowing into people's homes and, you know, help produce products and industry and whatnot. So that will lead to an increase in CO2 emissions from the power sector.
And let's say we have a big drought in the western United States. How much of a difference would it make that they had to kick in the natural gas generators or turn on the coal?
In our study, we studied the data record that we had from 2001 to 2015. So the advantage of that is that we draw our conclusions directly from observations. The drawback is that if there was not a big drought in a given year, in this time period in a given state, we might not be able to measure the response of the electricity sector in that state. So in this time period, 2001 to 2015, we especially saw important droughts occurring in the West Coast of the U.S., California, Washington, Oregon. And for those states specifically, we see an increase of about 10% in their emissions during drought years.
So it's not just hydroelectric power plants that are affected, as you said in your papers. I mean, fossil fuel plants need water for cooling, and even nuclear power plants need water for cooling. And if that water isn't available or it's too hot, they've got to shut down. So drought can affect that second stage of power production as well.
That's correct.
And what do your studies and the IPCC say about the evolution of drought for the coming decades as the Earth warms? What are the overall predictions?
Yes, it's a good question. Again, it depends on the region. For the Western U.S., we tend to be experiencing drying, at least from the soil perspective, the soil moisture perspective. So that's particularly important for agriculture and for vegetation. From the electricity generation side of things, the question is a bit trickier on one hand, because not all the models have consistent projections in terms of what's going to happen to rainfall and to runoff, which is the important variable to look at for recharge of rivers, which again are important for electricity generation. Having said that, with a warmer world, we're going to see decreasing snowpack, having more precipitation come down as rain instead of snow. And so that is going to affect, at least in the Western U.S., the generation during the spring and summer season, since there's going to be less snowmelt happening throughout the spring and into the summer that will help continue replenish the reservoirs. We might start seeing more rapid, you know, sort of rainfall events, again, because of this effect that you mentioned of the atmosphere being able to hold more capacity, and as well as the effect of temperature that makes it fall as rainfall instead of snowfall. So electricity in the future might have a, in the Western U.S., have it less reliable supply from hydro in the spring and summer months in the future.
And it seems like there's been a lot of severe droughts in the U.S. in the last 10 years. We had the 2011 drought in Texas, one in the U.S. Central Great Plains in 2012, and that five-year monster in California from 2012 to 2017. Is that normal, Julio, historically, say, or are we already experiencing the impact of climate change?
That's a good question. We are definitely already experiencing the impact. I mean, on one hand, drought is normal. We normally especially define drought as below normal water availability. And so that means, because of that definition, that's a relative to the normal, that a drought can happen everywhere, and even in semi-arid regions. But what we're seeing, especially in the U.S. and the Western U.S., is more prolonged droughts. And I'm not a particular expert in this subject, but there is also an understanding that this is part of a bigger mega drought of the Western U.S. We've basically had a drought in the Western U.S. for the last few decades, or a decade more or less. And so that's, again, not out of the long-term record, completely out of the ordinary, but it is more likely that we're having these type of large and long-lasting droughts because of climate change. Again, in large part because of this warming trend that increases evapotranspiration and offsets changes in rainfall that may be helping alleviate some of the drought.
And the news is full of mixed messages about drought in Africa. The Sahel is drying up, one says, while another talks about the future greening of Sahara. So I'm a little mixed up about it. Julio, you have studied African droughts. Is there a big picture developing there?
Yes, one of the things that makes it complicated to study drought in Africa and in other developing regions is a decreasing number of observations from the ground. We have fewer and fewer stations, hydrometeorological stations on the ground reporting, and relatively short records. So in terms of identifying trends, that makes it hard. And part of the reason for why we're starting to see in some ways a greening of the area is because there was a big drought in the Sahel in the second half of the 20th century. And with satellite records, which kicked in around the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s, we are looking at the recovery of the Sahel from those time periods, but it's a recovery from a long-lasting drought, if that makes sense. So it's not clear if that increasing trend is really more of a recovery or an actual increase, like long-term increasing trend. My understanding is that that region gets a lot of its water from the West African monsoon. And so there have been some studies that project a narrowing of the West African monsoon in terms of the time that it spans. If there's a delay in the onset or shorting in the end of the monsoon, that is going to have important implications for drought development in the region.
Radio EcoShock.
We're talking with Dr. Julio Herrera Estrada from Stanford. He researches the nature of droughts and their impacts on power generation and greenhouse gas emissions. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. In the plain language summary for your July 2017 paper, we find, quote, after droughts have grown and become intense enough, they will tend to become even larger and more intense before conditions improve. Julio, please talk to us about that.
Yes, that was an interesting behavior that we found of the droughts that we were studying, and we found this relationship to be true globally. Basically, we were looking at droughts that were the order of a few hundred thousand square kilometers, and we found that when droughts become that large, the propensity is for those droughts to continue growing further. In the observations, again, this was a data-driven study in where we identify the droughts, and then we see how the drought behaves after that. So we measured the probabilities of the droughts, you know, growing or shrinking, and ultimately we found that after the drought has reached those type of thresholds, area-wise and intensity-wise, or like the probability of the drought growing is higher than of the drought shrinking. So the drought will continue growing until it reaches again a turning point, and then it'll start alleviating.
So it can get worse before it gets better when you have a big one.
Yes, exactly. And you know, we still are in the process of studying why that might be. One of the hypotheses is that there are sort of positive feedbacks, vicious cycles, that, you know, when it's dry, there's less evaporation, and because there's less evaporation, there's less water in the atmosphere, water vapor in the atmosphere, and therefore there's a lower chance of rain. So you have, because there's been a lower chance of rain, that there's a drier soil, and again, that's a vicious cycle in a way. So we are potentially thinking of an example of a mechanism for why we might see this event where the droughts become larger and larger and more intense before they start to recover.
There's some real worry out there about super droughts coming even from some of the best climate scientists. I mean, Dr. Jonathan Overpeck back in 2005 raised the question of whether we were at the dawn of a super interglacial drought, as he called it. And then we had that February 2015 issue of Science Advances with Benjamin Cook and his co-authors. The title of the paper was Unprecedented 21st Century Drought Risk in the American Southwest and Central Plains. They suggest mega droughts worse than even happened in medieval times. What are your thoughts about all that?
Yeah, well, I mean, these are great researchers, and so they've asked really interesting questions. And the really interesting thing about the research is that they put the current droughts in the perspective of the paleo record, looking at, you know, hundreds, thousands of years, how normal or what's the probability of having droughts like the ones that we see today. So in terms of the science aspect of it, I think it's still an active area of research, understanding what are the drivers of these mega droughts, understanding what caused them in the past and if those mechanisms are becoming stronger in a definite way in the current climate. But from the other side, from the what do we do about it, I think it's also important to not get crippled by the, you know, potential uncertainty that we have in some of these projections.
I recently interviewed Dr. Victor, and it was a recent comment in the journal Nature by Shu Ramanathan and Victor, talking about three reasons global warming will be worse than previously thought. And one factor they pinpointed was a natural warming cycle coming out of interdecadal changes in ocean heat, mainly in the Pacific, but also changes in Atlantic mixing. My question for you is, did you see signs that these large ocean cycles are also affecting the droughts you study on land?
That's not been a focus of my research. The thing that's important note, and going back to what I mentioned about having enough observations, is that at least from the data that I've been using, has been mostly, you know, these global data sets that we have, they tend to go back around to 1980s, end of 1979, because that's when the satellite era sort of began. I've been focusing my work on this last, you know, 30, 40 years of data to understand these global aspects of the drought system from the observational record, or as close to the observational record as we can. However, the advantage that other paleo researchers have is that they identify proxies that can go back hundreds or thousands or millions of years into the past to help us understand the cycles. The ocean is a very interesting system that modulates in very long timescales the climate system. So we see this interdecadal shift, you know, again, as the name suggests, is over a period of many decades. And unfortunately, we don't have too many decades of data from satellites to be able to measure this directly. So normally, either people focus on using climate models to run experiments or look at this proxy measurements from paleoclimate to try to understand that span, again, multiple decades, multiple centuries, to understand the effect of this decadal variability from the ocean.
Well, here's a rather simple question, but if a part of the world stays in a drought so long that it seems permanent, when does a drought become a desert?
For example, I mean, even the UN has the two terms are, you know, drought and desertification. And as you mentioned, in some cases, a drought might really show a bigger trend underneath it. Like a drought is normally defined, as I mentioned, in some ways like a temporary deviation from what normal conditions are. As I said, everywhere experiences drier water conditions from time to time. And so the drought is the drier side. However, we start seeing a drying trend over a period of multiple years that just doesn't recover, that's what we start just calling desertification. And while some of the processes that are involved in both of these events, the droughts and desertification, might be similar, overall they're also very different processes. Because in one case, for example, for a drought, for example, a high-pressure system that's preventing, rainfall from reaching a given area. But if we have desertification, that shows a broader change in the latitude, for example, of pressure systems overall. It's not just a temporary pressure system that, you know, happened to be parked here, if that makes sense. It's part of a bigger long-term change that may be associated with this interdecadal variability that we see coming from the ocean, for example.
And from what you've seen, should we expect drought to significantly affect future food production?
I think so. And I think one thing that's also emerging is the study of the impact of droughts in different places at the same time, right? So if we have a drought in the U.S., but overall good conditions throughout the world, our global food trade network allows us to mitigate some of that, you know, shock to the food market. But if we start having multiple droughts simultaneously in different places, that might be important for our food supply globally. And, you know, that will be reflected in prices of commodities and food. And going back to what we mentioned at the beginning, with a higher temperature, there's a higher likelihood in general of a dry year becoming a drought year from the agricultural side of things.
What do you see as the remaining frontiers for scientific exploration of drought?
I think one aspect that we mentioned towards the end of one of my papers about how droughts move is precisely that we haven't studied thoroughly the movement or like how droughts behave in space and time simultaneously. We tend to focus on, for example, how a drought in California evolves, but that is a very limited picture. We need to broaden the view and understand how droughts in North America behave to understand how a drought in California might end up in the Midwest, for example. By studying that more, we can, and the drivers of that, it will hopefully also be allow us to predict droughts better in the future. And one thing that I also mentioned, should also mention is there is also a lot of work to be done in terms of understanding and characterizing drought risk, security, threats from droughts, because the impact of drought on agriculture is an obvious one. But the impact of drought on energy, or the impact of drought on the wastewater treatment sector, or how drought affects water utilities in general from a financial standpoint, those are questions that we haven't really asked much to in terms both of the science of drought as well as the impact of drought on the economy.
From Stanford University, we've been talking with the rising drought specialist, Dr. Julio Herrera Estrada. Julio is the lead author in the paper Responsive Electricity Sector Air Pollution Emissions to Drought Conditions in the Western United States. You can find links to this and to Julio's website in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Julio, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. It was a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can help educate everyone you know and the world by forwarding links to the Radio EcoShock shows and interviews. Help me get the voice of scientists out as far as we can. Get it at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's do it again next week.
Buddy, can you spare a dime?
And we're back. It's the Taylor Report. That was Peter, Paul, and Mary. That was Yip Harburg's song, Buddy, Can You Spare a Dime? And I think we are joined by Tony Leah, who is the chairman of the Political Action Committee of Unifor Local 222. Are you there, Tony?
Hi, I am, Phil.
Of course, we're speaking to you a little more frequently these days. You're living through a nightmare for the community of Oshawa and for the history of General Motors in Canada. Plant is being... We're told just before Christmas, it's always the time to do it, that there's going to be closing. But your local, your union, and other unions, of course, in the United States, United Auto Workers, who also have plants being scheduled for closure, are beginning to fight back. And I notice there's going to be an action on Friday, January the 18th, in downtown Detroit, and I believe you're part of that or intend to be part of it. Talk about these things, if you would.
I am planning to be there, and the retired workers chapter of Local 222 has arranged for a bus to take people from Oshawa to Detroit to take our fight right to the foot of the GM headquarters, which is a block or two away from where the rally is going to be held. Mm-hmm. And that rally is going to be at the North American or Detroit International Auto Show, which is the biggest auto show in the world. There's likely to be 6,000 or 8,000 journalists there. That's how big a deal it is. And mm-hmm. there's a charity gala event on the Friday evening, and so that's where there's going to be a protest rally. And it's a joint effort. It's co-sponsored by the Detroit Democratic Socialists of America, Auto Worker Caravan, which is a group of rank-and-file auto workers, members of the UIW from different locals mm-hmm. in the Detroit area, and our local political action committee and retirees and some other groups. Uh-huh. And to me, it's extremely exciting that we're actually going to have, for the first time that I can remember, auto workers from the United States and Canada joining together in a battle against these corporations, which are really playing havoc with everybody's lives.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot. I think many Canadians are a little frustrated. They're not hearing a lot, if anything, sort of the cricket sound, I think, on this issue from elected officials. I suppose, well, some have said things, but it seems to be so far that your part of your struggle is to get their focused attention, right?
That's right. We should expect our governments to represent us, to represent the public interest. And we've seen far too much of governments kowtowing to corporations or trying to make things easier than them. Mm-hmm. One of the things I like about the rally that we're joining in Detroit is it's raising this broader issue of challenging the logic of capitalism. Mm-hmm. GM seems to think that their justification for opening or closing plants or treating workers and communities like pawns is as long as it makes them more profit. Mm-hmm. But they draw on public resources. They have gotten big handouts from governments whenever they've asked. They use the infrastructure of communities. And, of course, the workers are creating the value that they're benefiting from.
Talk about some of that value. Your big product is the pickups, right, or trucks?
Sure. GM, like a lot of the auto companies right now in North America especially, are focusing almost entirely on SUVs and pickup trucks because they make incredible profits on them. They make about GM makes about $15,000 profit from each pickup truck that they make. And then, of course, that profit, that value is coming from the work of the workers in the plants that are assembling the vehicles. Mm-hmm. But it's huge, and it's it amounts to, just in our plant, where we produce 440 pickup trucks a day. That's $6.6 million of profit daily at GM.
Do the math, as you say.
Yeah, do the math.
This is Tony Lea. He is the political action chair at the local 222 Unifor. You must have seen this article today by Jennifer Wells, Toronto Star. GM stocks rise as unions rally against automaker. And she basically says, you know, we could have made that, it's a tale of two cities. Of course, and she sets her article with your demonstration in Windsor last week,
yes.
A few days ago. And then across the river is a meeting was going on where the president was not at all uncomfortable in her report to the kind of people who want to hear about big numbers from them. Did you have any thoughts about that story?
The investors clearly are happy with the direction GM is going in because they are investing their money with GM and taking their profits in wheelbarrows to the banks. There's zero concern about the impact that it has on workers or communities, either by GM or by the people they're appealing to invest with them. And of course, that is exactly the problem. How long can we allow our entire society to be perverted to the benefit only of those corporations? Mm-hmm. And they're parasitic. Mm-hmm. They're sucking the lifeblood out of our communities, out of workers. And when is somebody going to say, our role here is to stop you from doing that on behalf of what's in the public good? What is the public interest here? What's the broader interest?
Mm-hmm.
That's really what our governments should be doing. And it's long past time the governments here, the Ontario government and the government of Canada, expressed a desire to protect that public interest instead of just,
Well, part of the problem
helping
comes
GM is on with their code is their reason.
They do have a kind of asterisk beside the word democracy and freedom. They mean democracy and freedom of a capitalist system, which they define as freedom. Do they not?
Exactly. Yes. That's,
so they're when they. They expect to be talked to the boss, the guy who owns that place, and work it out. And then you, the Unifor, and working people in Canada are somebody they simply report back to after the guy with property has answered all their questions.
Doug Ford expressed that very clearly when GM made their announcement.
Now that's a charm
said,
of old Doug.
He said, I talked to them, and they said they're not going to change their mind. The ship has left the dock.
Yeah, the ship
he said
is
it during the election debate. Also, when he was debating during the provincial election, he actually said, "You should ask your employer what's going to happen. You know why you should vote for the Conservatives."
Yeah,
he thought Ontario voters should ask their employers what was best.
We seem to be the pit bull level of capitalism at the moment, where they put aside the folly swaddles and just give it to you by heavy dose.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, now on the political front, I was struck by something, and it's available on YouTube at I think facebook.com/GM Oshawa Matters videos, but there is a wonderful congresswoman just been elected, and she attended the meetings of the Democratic Socialists of America, right, and spoke about this?
She's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. That's Rashida Tlaib.
I say that because I'm trying to recruit a few NDPers to join, you know.
It is a revelation that political leaders in the United States can use the word socialist and get elected and raise important ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love the NDP to rethink their decision to remove the word socialist from their program.
What is her name? She's the one who spoke of Trump's future in his own favorite language. She cursed rather profoundly or sharply or I don't know.
She did, and she said that when she was asked what she intended to do in Congress with Trump, she said that we're going to impeach the mother.
Yeah,
basically.
Exactly. Some reference to his mother, you know.
Yes. Yes.
And she got national attention. And by the way, I mean, I bet you're one of those who agrees that let's bring it on. I mean, she certainly is not afraid of somebody reacting to that because she said, look what you're doing to working people of America.
That's right. And her constituents. And 82% of the people in Detroit in her district voted for her to send her to Congress to send that kind of message. Mm-hmm. And yes, she was at the meeting to protest GM's plant closures that was held in Detroit in December. I don't know if she's going to be there this Friday, but her organization is one of the co-sponsors of it, the group that she's part of, the Democratic Socialists of America.
Mm-hmm. Now, incidentally, this is Tony Lea. He's the political action chair at Unifor Local 222 and has been attending the rallies. There's been a number of them. And you gave an interview to Labor Notes, a widely read and highly respected publication. I hope people go to that detailed interview. You are one of those who are pointing out that there is a future for people building autos, but it has to be recognized that we are going into this period of electric self-driven vehicles. And mm-hmm. Why not? I think you've raised the issue. Why not begin new? You know, the Oshawa is the home of General Motors building cars. So, what can you talk about the subject of that and maybe the possibility of building electric cars in Oshawa?
That is the future of the industry for sure, and if we want to be part of that, the workers in the Oshawa plant, I think, along with governments, should be exercising more power. We shouldn't be leaving it up to GM.
Well, they gave them $9 billion when they had a little problem a few years back.
Yeah, governments gave
them. Why couldn't they say, that's what we're ready to do that. We want in on the future. We're going to build an electric car.
Yeah, I think that governments ought to.
Whoop. Unintended interruption. In football, that's called an interception. We'll try to get him back on the line. I think he's probably staring at his phone. Are you there? I thought I heard a glimmer.
You heard a sudden click.
Yeah. Now, you saw the Labor Notes interview.
Yes, I did. I circulated it widely among my colleagues.
I was very impressed with the detail and the clarity of the of it. It gave us a lot of background. Tony, are you there?
I'm here.
I don't know what we did, but we apologize. So, about the electric car, why can't Canada say we gave you the money because we wanted the jobs in Canada? So now let's find an automaker who wants to build electric cars, and Canada's the government's ready to chip in.
I agree. If corporations are willing to walk away from communities after they've made profits from them, then the public interest and the interest of the workers should be in saying, well, you're not going to take this away from us. We'll take it away from you, and then we'll look around to see what productive work can be done that's necessary to transition to renewable energy, whether it be through electric vehicles or wind turbines or solar energy. And perhaps what partners we can bring in to work with that. And I think that it's noteworthy in the world today that the center of electric vehicle production is actually in China. And I've been doing a little bit of reading up on it. Mm-hmm. They produced in the first 10 months, I think, of last year, 726,000 electric vehicles in China. That's a really substantial number.
That's probably more than Canada.
Well, we didn't produce any electric vehicles in Canada. Yeah, it's more than zero. But even all of the vehicles that were produced in Canada in 2018 were about 2 million.
Oh.
So China is, I don't know how many people realize how substantial their economic growth has been with a socialist model of developing the economy, but they produced 29 million vehicles in China in 2017. The United States produced 11 million. Canada about 2 million. So and they also sold 28 million vehicles in China. So the Chinese companies, many with either government ownership or co-ownership, are really developing the technological.
Do they develop any outside China?
That's the direction that they're going in now. Some of the companies, the Chinese companies, are looking to open operations in North America, that I was just reading about, which is, I think that...
I heard that there might be a production in California.
Well, that's right, yes. Tianzhu Motor, the Chinese company, and they have an agreement with Mullen Technologies in California. They say they've signed a partnership agreement to co-develop, assemble, and exclusively market the Kiantu K50, which is an entirely electric vehicle, in North America. Within the next year, they're projecting. And I think they're looking around for a location to assemble those vehicles in.
Couldn't you guys run a flag up and say, hey, over here?
I think
there's a lot of skilled workers in Oshawa ready to make a car if you want to come build it.
They're looking for a facility. We've got more than a facility. We've got a facility, and we've got 2,000 highly skilled workers with experience in building vehicles of the highest quality.
Yeah. Now, Cadillac in the States, and everybody understands that the word Cadillac immediately means luxury, but they are starting to build something. But it's of a different type of market that they're looking toward, right?
GM has said that they're shifting their development of electric vehicles to the Cadillac division of GM, and GM is certainly going to be putting a lot of resources in developing electric vehicles over the next number of years. A lot of the engineering work is actually being done in Canada, in Oshawa, Toronto, Markham, and Kitchener. And that's, I think, also a powerful argument for saying that the manufacturing facility, which is in the center of those areas, ought to be where that type of vehicle is prototyped, developed, tested, and eventually assembled. Mm-hmm. But if GM's not going to do that, I think that governments need to say, you have forfeited your right to own those resources. If you're not going to use them for the public good, we're going to take them over, along with the workers in the plant, and start considering alternatives, because it's more important to the public interest to do that than to just allow corporations to play communities off against each other.
Yeah. Again, this is Tony. We're speaking to Tony Lea, and he is a political action chair at Unifor Local 222, Oshawa. Tony, so lastly, again, so this the next action of note is this is coming up, and tell us again what's going to happen, and maybe where people can go to learn more about these things.
It's at the Detroit Auto Show at Cobo Center in downtown Detroit this coming Friday at 5:30 p.m. from 5:30 to 7. There's going to be a rally that's held by this Coalition for a Green New Deal, raising these broader ideas of curbing the power of corporations and start recognizing the need to reorient our economy, not in the interest of profit, but broader public good. And I think that people will be able to find that event if they look on Facebook for Detroit Democratic Socialists or Auto Worker Caravan.
Auto Workers Caravan, yeah.
And there'll be a lot of very good people there taking our demands right to GM and to the press, the biggest auto industry event of the year.
Yeah. Well, it's been very informative. Tony Lea, we're very grateful. Thank you very, very much.
Talk to you later, Phil.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marjorie Cohn, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, who assesses the legality of Trump's threat to declare a national emergency in order to bypass Congress and get funding to build his southern border wall. Donnie Bloomfield, a student at Yale Law School's Rule of Law Clinic, who discusses the NAACP lawsuit launched in Connecticut that challenges the widespread practice known as prison gerrymandering, and Ronnie Cummins of the Organic Consumers Association, who examines the proposed Green New Deal legislation and its potential to unite small farmers and working-class families to promote renewable energy and advance economic and racial justice. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The long-delayed presidential election in the Democratic Republic of the Congo fell into confusion as the National Elections Commission named Felix Tshisekedi the winner, who was trailing by double digits in pre-election polls. The candidate who took second place, former oil executive Martin Fayulu, challenged the credibility of the election results in court. The Catholic Church in the DRC, which had mobilized 40,000 election monitors, disputed the commission results but refused to name Fayulu the winner. Inside the Congo, it's widely suspected that Tshisekedi cut a deal with the ruling party's outgoing president, Joseph Kabila. It was hoped that this election would usher in the first peaceful transfer of power since U.S. ally dictator Mobutu Sese Seko seized power in the early 1960s. The election outcome is now in the hands of the Constitutional Court, which can affirm the official results, order a recount, or call for new elections. There are growing fears of political violence across the DRC as the election outcome remains in doubt. The Democratic Republic of the Congo is the source of two-thirds of the world's supply of cobalt used to power electric cars and smartphones. An investigation by ProPublica found that over the last 4 years, U.S. veterans sent by the U.S. government to receive health care from private physicians have endured longer wait times, and taxpayers have been paying higher costs than standard Veterans Administration care. In 2014, the VA established Veterans Choice as an alternative to long waiting periods for treatment. The program, launched quickly with little time for basic preparation, awarded two large private health contractors, HealthNet and TriWest Healthcare Alliance, the ability to charge $2 billion in overhead, exceeding the limits of private insurers under the Affordable Care Act. The Trump White House has prioritized the privatization of the VA and is often at odds with veterans groups who support the quality of care their members receive in VA programs. According to the VA's Inspector General, prior to the Veterans Choice Program, HealthNet and TriWest provided similar services for one-sixth the cost to taxpayers. Moreover, audits found the two contractors overcharged the U.S. government $140 million between November 2014 and March 2017. The companies are now under criminal investigation for excessive billing. Still, the Trump administration has expanded TriWest's contract without competitive bidding. 2 years ago, New Jersey approved the Criminal Justice Reform Act, which uses a risk assessment algorithm to determine if a defendant should be jailed without bail pending trial. According to In These Times magazine, the goal of the legislation is to phase out money bail, which has resulted in tens of thousands of low-income defendants sitting in jail. Under the New Jersey law that employs algorithms, some defendants are denied bail completely due to risk factors such as having a history of failing to appear for court dates or violent crimes. But last July, more than 100 social justice groups, including the ACLU, the NAACP, and MoveOn.org, publicly came out in opposition to New Jersey's algorithm system, arguing that the data-driving conditions of bail, such as prior failures to appear and arrest rates, reflects systemic biases against people of color. They recommended simply ending money bail and dramatically reducing pretrial detention without introducing risk assessment tools. However, supporters of the New Jersey reforms claim it has led to a 25% drop in the state's pretrial prison population over the last 2 years, while they recognize that the law is only what they call a critical first step. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After more than 3 weeks of a partial U.S. government shutdown, where more than 800,000 federal workers have either been furloughed or forced to work without a paycheck, there's been little progress toward negotiating a solution. President Trump's demand for Congress to allocate $5.7 billion to build a wall along the length of the U.S.-Mexico border triggered the shutdown soon after right-wing commentators criticized the president for signals that he was about to back down on his election campaign pledge. But before his January 8th nationally televised address on what the president described as a border crisis, Mr. Trump threatened to declare a national emergency in order to secure the funds Congress denied him to build his border wall. In 1976, Congress passed the National Emergencies Act, which permits a president to declare a national emergency when he deems it appropriate. But the act offers no specific definition of emergency, and constitutional scholars have challenged the legality of declaring an emergency to justify an end run around Congress. Although in recent days Trump has said he's backing off the idea of an emergency declaration, the possibility still exists that it could be employed to end the government shutdown. Your reporter spoke with Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. Here she talks about her recent article titled, If Trump Declares a National Emergency, He'll Be Breaking the Law.
Well, the only national emergency besides real and national emergencies like climate change, which is a bona fide national emergency, has been created by Trump. Now, in terms of declaring a national emergency, which he may see as the only way to reopen the government without giving in on his wall demand, he would be on shaky ground. During the Korean War, President Harry Truman tried to seize the steel mills to avoid a union strike that would have shut them down, and Truman was claiming authority in support of the war effort, and yet the Supreme Court shot him down. All the justices were Democratic appointees, and he was a Democrat as well. The 6-3 majority shot him down and said, no, you can't do that. And the seminal case is Youngstown versus Sawyer. Justice William O. Douglas wrote a concurring opinion, and he said, the president cannot usurp Congress's spending power to approve money to pay for the taking of the steel mill's private property. It would be a similar situation here. The Constitution gives only Congress the power of the purse. Justice Robert Jackson, who took a leave from the Supreme Court to be the chief U.S. prosecutor at the Nuremberg war crimes trial, wrote a concurring opinion with three prongs, and that is the litmus test for measuring executive power. And I should say that Justice Jackson cited Hitler's use of a temporary suspension of rights to take full power in Nazi Germany. So I know that people get nervous when you make comparisons with Nazi Germany, but Justice Robert Jackson did that himself. Now, in terms of the three-pronged test from Youngstown, which we must apply and the Supreme Court ultimately would probably apply to determine whether or not Trump's declaration of a national emergency was legal, are as follows. The first prong is that when the president acts with express or implied authority of Congress, his power is at its greatest. Congress has not appropriated $5.7 billion to build Trump's wall, and if he were to declare a national emergency to fund the wall, Trump would not be acting with the authority of Congress. the second prong of the Youngstown test is that in the absence of a grant or prohibition by Congress, the president can rely only on his own powers. And Justice Jackson said the president would be acting in a zone of twilight where he and Congress may have concurrent authority, or it would be unclear how the distribution of power between Congress and the executive would be. It depends on the situation. So Trump would probably try to invoke the National Emergencies Act of 1976, which was actually passed to limit the president's ability to declare a national emergency, although it does include the responsibility of Congress to override a declaration of national emergency, and that would take two-thirds of the Congress. But that act would not apply, would not support Trump's declaration of a national emergency in this situation, because that act only allows the president to divert funds that have not been obligated and use them for construction projects that are necessary to support the military. Now, there's been some talk that he is considering taking some of the funds that have been allocated for disaster relief, such as in Puerto Rico after the hurricane or in California after the fires, and use them for his wall. But they have been obligated. They've been obligated for those disasters. But assuming that he could use them, assuming they hadn't been obligated, he would have to use them for construction projects that are necessary to support the military. Now, he would argue that the military is at the border helping the Customs and Border Protection because he sent thousands of U.S. troops to the border. But the use of the military to enforce domestic law, and immigration is domestic law, is prohibited by the Posse Comitatus Act. So any attempt by Trump to declare an emergency in order to justify diverting funds for his wall to help the military enforce immigration law would violate the Posse Comitatus Act. And then the third prong from the Youngstown case is when the president seeks to circumvent the express or implied will of Congress, his power is at its lowest ebb. He can only rely on his own constitutional powers, and presidential claim to such power must be scrutinized with caution. In addition to being illegal, and I think it is, it's also an abuse of power. It's a cynical political stunt. I think that everybody realizes that, or at least most people realize it. It's an abuse of power, and abuse of power was one of the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. So the House of Representatives, which is now in Democratic hands, could issue articles of impeachment against Trump. I mean, there's obstruction of justice and all kinds of other charges they could bring as well. But impeachment is a political process, according to Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers, and abuse of power, even if it's not a crime, is still grounds for impeachment.
That was Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's author of the recently updated edition of Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. For more commentary and analysis of the president's emergency powers in the context of the current government shutdown, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In most states, except for Vermont and Maine, incarcerated citizens cannot vote. Yet inmates, for the purpose of determining voting representation, are counted in the population of the town that hosts the prison where they are being held, rather than in their home communities. Now, the National NAACP and its Connecticut state affiliate have sued in federal district court in Bridgeport to try to win a reversal of this practice. It's the first statewide lawsuit of its kind in the U.S., where there are currently more than 13,000 persons incarcerated in Connecticut. In addition to the NAACP, five individual voters are party to the lawsuit, including one formerly incarcerated person. The plaintiffs come from cities that have lost electoral representation due to this practice, which disproportionately affects people of color, especially African Americans. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Donnie Bloomfield, a student at Yale Law School's Rule of Law Clinic, which is representing the NAACP, its Connecticut affiliate, and the individual local plaintiffs in this suit taking action to stop Connecticut's practice of what's known as prison gerrymandering. Here, Bloomfield explains the status of the lawsuit and what plaintiffs hope it will accomplish.
What our clients are suing the state about is a practice called prison gerrymandering. And prison gerrymandering is a practice where the state uses incarcerated persons in allocating its legislative districts by counting incarcerated persons where they're held, where they're incarcerated, instead of where they live and where they're really from. And what this ultimately means, to just get to the bottom line of how this harms our clients, is it dilutes the votes of people in the cities and the places where incarcerated people are ultimately from. The way you can look at that is by thinking that for every 9 votes or so for people in some of these places where these prisons are located, it takes 10 votes to get the same electoral power for the larger districts in Connecticut, because even though prisoners are not allowed to vote, even though incarcerated people are not allowed to vote, their bodies are counted towards the districting of these northern districts, predominantly white districts. And what you see is that in the cities and in the predominantly African American and Latino communities where a lot of these incarcerated people are from, they are not having those people counted towards their electoral power, even though it's in their interest that the southern legislators are also working.
Not only does it dilute the voting power of the communities they come from, it adds to the voting power of where the prisons are located.
Exactly, exactly. It's this perverse double punch is one of the ways that we talk about it in the lawsuit, where you see these predominantly white areas having, you know, largely African Americans and Latinos very disproportionately being brought there and counted towards their electoral power, even though these folks can't vote, and that power and those votes are being taken away from the families and communities where these incarcerated people are ultimately from.
So what are you trying to accomplish exactly?
We're trying to get the federal judge to declare this practice of prison gerrymandering unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment and ultimately have Connecticut stop it by counting incarcerated people where they're really truly residents instead of where they happen to be held.
And the 14th Amendment, just remind us, why do you claim it's unconstitutional under that amendment?
Sure. So one of the clauses of the 14th Amendment protects equal protection under the law. And according to a number of Supreme Court cases, this is where the right to one person, one vote vests. So that protects the right of one person to equal power in their government. And that's what we're looking for here, where we don't see that equal protection and we don't see that equal representation, because you have this vote dilution going on in the South and empowering those northern districts with the bodies of incarcerated people.
So has this ever been done before, to your knowledge, anywhere in the country?
There have been a very small number of lawsuits, federal lawsuits brought against prison gerrymandering. This is the first one that's challenging on a statewide basis. There was a successful suit in Florida that challenged a municipal practice of prison gerrymandering. And there was a case in Rhode Island where that was ultimately unsuccessful that was challenging a local practice of prison gerrymandering there. But this is the first statewide challenge that's being brought.
It seems like for decades there was this tough-on-crime view by pretty much all politicians and people in communities too. And now it seems to be shifting for a variety of reasons, one of which is that it's ridiculous how we incarcerate like some very high percentage of all the incarcerated people in the entire world. So I was wondering if you think the shift in the perception of prisoners, in other words, instead of locking them up and throwing away the key, there seems to be more interest now in considering what happens when most of these people, when they get out, because most of them get out eventually. Do you think that will make a difference in terms of what you are trying to accomplish in your lawsuit?
Definitely. And I think that the NAACP obviously really cares about the larger issues and the individual plaintiffs that we represent in this suit. They really care about criminal justice reform, and it's something that they see this as part of, this lawsuit as part of a broader effort to ultimately reduce some of the real terrible consequences that have resulted from these tough on crime measures and from these extremely long and arduous prison terms, and as part of a broader push to see incarcerated people as people instead of just prisoners.
Can you say anything about the timeline?
What's happened so far is that last year the NAACP and the rest of our clients filed suit, and then the state made a motion to dismiss, and we responded, and the issue is now sitting before the judge on whether to allow the suit to move forward and move forward hopefully into discovery and ultimately trial and hopefully a final verdict in our favor. So that's where we're standing right now. We're waiting to hear from the judge on what he thinks the merits of the suit are to advance into the next stage.
That was Donnie Bloomfield with Yale Law School's Rule of Law Clinic. Learn more about the Connecticut prison gerrymandering lawsuit by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Late last year on December 10th, around 150 protesters from the youth-led Sunrise Movement were arrested outside incoming Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi's office, demanding bold action on climate change. Newly elected New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez addressed the demonstrators and put forward a proposal for a Green New Deal that calls for a 10-year plan to neutralize the United States' greenhouse gas emissions, move the nation toward adopting 100% renewable energy, and reduce growing income inequality. While the Sunrise Movement has received praise for forcefully bringing the issue to Democratic House leadership, neither Speaker Pelosi, House Majority Whip Steny Hoyer, or Chair of the House Rules Committee Jim McGovern have endorsed the Green New Deal proposal and have given early indications that they regard a program of this breadth and depth to be a bridge too far. Between the Lines' Richard Hill spoke with Ronnie Cummins, co-founder and international director of the Organic Consumers Association, who assesses the Green New Deal proposal and offers his perspective on its holistic, systemic approach that has the potential to unite small farmers, working-class families, and organic activists in a movement to promote renewable energy conversion while also advancing economic and racial justice.
The basic idea is that we've got a crisis of the system like we had back in the 1930s in the U.S. that can't be fixed with small changes here and there. We need a package of political reforms at the federal, state, and local level that can address the literal climate emergency that we're facing, but that can fix other major problems at the same time that preoccupy people and justifiably. When you have 80% of the public living from paycheck to paycheck and a third of the public in the United States living in literal poverty, you can't expect people to wake up in the morning and think about solving the climate change problem. People wake up in the morning and they think about how they're going to pay their bills. They think about the health problems. They think about the student debt. They think about the fact that they don't make enough money to cover their bills, much less purchase organic food. They think about a lot of issues that are all important, and they don't wake up thinking about preserving organic standards or carbon sequestration through regenerative organic methods in grazing and crop production. But that doesn't mean that these folks can't become our allies in the food and farming and climate change movement. It just means that we have to address the basic necessities of people as we move to solve what leading climate scientists are now telling us is we've got to turn things around aggressively in the next 12 years or we're going to lose control and it's going to be horrible. We're not going to convince everyday people to forget about their health problems, their job problems, their families' problems, their kids' lack of job opportunities, their deteriorating environment and poison water and all these other things. But if we package what we believe, which is a revitalization of the organic and regenerative sector, into a package like the Green New Deal that says basically we'll give jobs to everyone who wants to work, rebuilding our society, rural and urban, or renewable energy and sustainability, they'll sit up and take notice. The brilliance of the Green New Deal is similar to the brilliance of Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal in the 30s and 40s, which is it's not a single reform. It's a package of reforms designed to alter a degenerate system, which is what we have right now. But I think we're going to be able to build a very large national coalition, bigger than we've ever had in the food and farming movement, around this issue. Because we can't go forward with a peace movement over here, a food movement over here, a fair trade movement over here, a climate movement over here, economic justice movement over here, social justice movement. We've got to break down the silo walls and work together, because we do not have unlimited time to solve these problems. And the longer the problems go unsolved, as we can see from recent political developments in the U.S., Brazil, Hungary, Poland, really many places, is we're creating a climate for fascism if we don't deal with the everyday needs of working class people and the majority of the population. We can't go forward as a climate movement anymore thinking that we can actually save the climate just based on the strength of our arguments that we've got to stop emitting fossil fuel emissions and that we've got to stop doing destructive land use practices. We got to come together in a way that people have not in the United States for 70 years. And one thing we can draw hope from the fact that Mexico has taken a decisive step in this direction. In July, the Morena Party, which is called the Movement for National Regeneration of Mexico, swept the elections, not just the executive branch, but both houses of Congress. And they came into power December 1st. But they are already making sweeping changes to implement what can only be described as a Green New Deal, where they're trying to deal with poverty, corruption, migration, agriculture, food sovereignty, climate at the same time. And they're immensely popular in Mexico. This is the most popular government that there's been since the 1930s, when there was the last decent government in Mexico, which was patterned on the New Deal, Lázaro Cárdenas. So there are signs across the world that this has been a very dark hour, 2018, but that we can now move into a new era if we'll wake up and get organized.
That was Ronnie Cummins, co-founder and international director of the Organic Consumers Association. Learn more about the Green New Deal by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, KRBX in Boise, Idaho, KYAQ in Toledo, Oregon, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Cracks in the walls of empire. Begets
As we gather today, we do so amid the fire and smoke of chaos, both figuratively and literally. In France, the city of light, Paris, is surrounded by the flames of discontent. The rural communities are up in arms about lowering wages and the hiking of taxes. These people, clad in their yellow vests, feel that they are forgotten by the central government and often ignored by them and the urban elites. In Britain, the nation is trying to come to terms with a serious, self-imposed wound, Brexit. Brexit, or a British exit from the European Union, is a British attempt to go it alone. But to do so means that the country will lose billions of pounds or dollars as international companies flee from London. And as jobs also leave the country, London, called the city for its impressive economic strength, is frittering away that strength because of Brexit. The U.S. economy, roaring like a lion as it breaks all records of the Dow Stock Exchange, is now falling like stones as stocks reflect losses that bring to mind the Great Depression of the 1930s. Why should we worry about such things? Because when the economy falls, when economic insecurity enters a nation, it opens the door to fear. And history has shown us that it opens the door into fascism. Europe is already home to formidable rightist forces. The events of a year ago in Charlottesville, Virginia, showed the sinister flash of fascism in a major American city. These fears, once unleashed, cannot be easily brought back under control. These furies of the mind light fires in consciousness, and fires in the mind can only too soon become fires in fact, which consumes and destroys societies. Fascism, or the collusion of corporate power with state governmental power, can result when traditional governments have failed to resolve economic problems in states awash in economic insecurity. John Bellamy Foster, editor of the American Socialist magazine Monthly Review, defines fascism as characterized by its virulently xenophobic, ultra-nationalist tendencies, which is rooted primarily in the lower middle class and relatively privileged sections of the working class, in alliance with monopoly capital. History has shown that the deification of leaders and, well, as the exaltation of the military is also a feature of fascist states. As capitalism reaches its market limits, it seeks other forms through which it can extract profits. Fascism. The late German dramatist Bertolt Brecht asks in 1935, how can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he is willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth? Thus, we can glimpse a key relationship between fascism and capitalism. One is but a tool of an economic system which utilizes the other for power and profit. One would think that the heinous and horrors of massacres of World War II would awaken us to the fascism and the neo-fascism that we see emerging in Europe and the U.S. One would think, yes. But neoliberalism itself, a political system designed to serve corporate interests by betraying the public sphere for private capitalist accumulation, has prepared the ground for this neo-fascist and crypto-fascist ascendancy. Neoliberalists like the Clintons built the machine we now name mass incarceration. How could this not strengthen and deepen a system built on repression of workers, racism, and corporate control and domination? In Britain, Brexit spells economic disaster and the devolution of Britain as one of the centers of Europower. In France, attempts to operate the nation as if it were a simple business run by a banker has run into a wall, one richly emblazoned with mottos comparing the president with kings who face the guillotine. In America, the notion of president who was a businessman has lost much of its luster as the state appears like a site of chaos and sheer incompetence. And beneath it all lurks the threat of fascism, ugly, racist, profoundly undemocratic, and beholden only to corporate capitalist power. It is a time for all of us of awakening. Thank you for your time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Greetings, comrades, friends, brothers, sisters. As a new year dawns, it is important to view developments happening in the West with new, cool eyes. Socialists often see each critical event as a crisis in capitalism. True, but how often must it be said before the cry sounds like the little boy crying wolf? As we examine events in France, specifically the explosion of the yellow vests, mostly working class rural communities who dare to compare their present political leaders with French Revolution era kings who were sent to the guillotine, well, something's happening. When Britain faces what is essentially a self-imposed expulsion from the EU, the European Union, and its concomitant loss of billions in world trade and almost countless jobs lost, something is happening. When the U.S. has rises and falls on the stock market that harkens back to the 1930s, when the Great Depression was raging, something is happening. And when we factor in the West's recent penchant for toying with fascist movements, well, something is indeed happening, and it ain't pretty. Is this a crisis of capitalism? Yes, for it is global as opposed to national. And the incipient rise of fascist movements followed inexorably from the neoliberalism that brought us unprecedented mass incarceration, the result of state and police repression against black, Latino, and poor white communities. That repression opened the door to the
the right is moving. We see waxing on the periphery. Why? Because movements are always in flux. They never stand still. The same could be said for the movements of workers, the poor, and national minorities. If we don't take advantage of this moment, this hour of chaos, we will all come to regret it. Thank you. On the move from imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
What does the failure of Theresa May's Brexit deal mean for UK politics and for the future of the region? Will the treaty to be signed in Aachen on January 22nd serve as a step in the direction of EU military integration? What distinguishes the Yellow Vest protests in France from past protests against austerity in that country and elsewhere in the world? How are the Yellow Vests being undermined by state authorities, and will those authorities prevail in the end? On this week's Global Research News Hour, as the political drama around Brexit plays out in the UK Parliament, we take a look at popular resistance to the European Union as it is playing out in both the United Kingdom and France. In the first part of our show, economist and geopolitical analyst Peter Koenig provides some background on the European Union itself and why it is generating so much popular resistance. In the second half, Diana Johnstone joins us from France to help us understand the Yellow Vest phenomenon and efforts by the Macron government and the media to suppress it. On this week's program, Vive la Résistance, Brexit, Yellow Vests, and the Fate of the EU. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 18th, 2019. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeg-Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiwak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The crime of attacking another nation maintains an absolutely unaltered legal status whether or not NATO is involved. Yet NATO is used within the U.S. and by other NATO members as cover to wage wars under the pretense that they are somehow more legal or acceptable. This misconception is not the only way in which NATO works against the rule of law. Placing a primarily U.S. war under the banner of NATO also helps to prevent congressional oversight of that war. Placing nuclear weapons in non-nuclear nations in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty is also excused with the claim that the nations are NATO members. So what? That comes from the article Top 10 Reasons Not to Love NATO by David Swanson, posted January 17th, originally published at the author's blog site, davidswanson.org. On January 7th, a fourth-generation Okinawan-American and local peace groups staged a demonstration and delivered a petition with 190,000 signatures to the White House. The petition calls for a halt of construction of a U.S. airbase at Uruan Bay until the referendum can be held on February 24th. The airbase would build an airstrip by filling in Uruan Bay with boulders and dirt. Two 5,000-foot runways are planned, which will eventually house the ultra-advanced U.S. F-35 fighter jets and V-22 tiltrotor aircraft. The bay is a pristine tropical water paradise and home to many rare aquatic species, including the dugong, an endangered rare marine mammal. That comes from the article, Okinawa activists petition White House to stop military base construction by John Zangas. Post January 17th, originally published at DC Media Group. Teacher shortages are most often blamed on low teacher pay, one of the commonalities across teacher strikes. These shortages are arguably exacerbated by an increase in the teacher pay penalty, the term used to describe disparities in teacher salary compared to professions requiring comparable levels of education. At the same time teachers find themselves increasingly undervalued, most states are still funding their public education systems at levels below that of the 2008 recession. This includes California, which is ranked 41st nationwide in per pupil spending when adjusted for cost of living. As long as public schools remain underfunded, the nation can expect to see more teacher strikes in other school districts and states in the near future. That comes from the article, Three Reasons to Pay Attention to the L.A. Teacher Strike, by Professor Aaron McHenry Sorber, posted January 17th, originally published at theconversation.com. In 2019, people in the U.S. are facing monumental challenges with the longest federal government shutdown in history, the continuing rise in racism and gender-based violence, the threat of another recession due to overproduction, the imposition of tariffs and intensification of labor practices, which is leading to an ever-widening gap between the rich and poor. The Pentagon budget, which Dr. King and others vigorously attacked in the late 1960s, has grown exponentially, resulting in hundreds of military bases across the world and the active engagement of U.S. troops in many geopolitical regions throughout Africa, Asia, and Latin America. As Dr. King realized after 1966, there is no fundamental political differences between the Democratic and Republican parties. Both entities represent the capitalist class, which perpetuates national oppression, class divisions, and imperialism around the world. The assassination of Dr. King and a host of other African-American leaders during the 1960s, such as Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, Fred Hampton, the isolation and imprisonment of hundreds of others, and the destruction of people's organizations, had a tremendous impact in stifling the historical trajectory of the revolutionary struggle. That comes from the article, Martin Luther King Commemorations Take Place Amid Government Shutdown and Worsening Capitalist Crisis, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted January 17th. The report has become a key talking point of political progressives in the U.S. who, like journalist and activist Naomi Klein, are now speaking of a terrifying 12 years left in which to cut fossil fuel emissions. There is, however, a problem with even this approach. It assumes that the scientific conclusions in the IPCC report are completely sound. It's well known, however, that there has been a political element built into the IPCC's scientific process based on the urge to get as many countries as possible on board the Paris Climate Agreement and other attempts to rein in climate change. To do that, such reports tend to use the lowest common denominator in their projections, which makes their science overly conservative, that is, overly optimistic. That comes from the article, A Planet in Crisis, The Heat's on Us, by Dar Jamail, posted January 17th, originally appearing at Tom Dispatch. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
Mr. Speaker, the House has spoken and the government will listen. It is clear that the House does not support this deal, but tonight's vote tells us nothing about what it does support. Nothing about how. Nothing about how or even if it intends to honour the decision the British people took in a referendum Parliament decided to hold. And people, particularly EU citizens who've made their home here, and UK citizens living in the EU, deserve clarity on these questions as soon as possible.
In the United Kingdom, Theresa May's Brexit deal got rejected in a parliamentary vote on Tuesday, January 15th, although she survived a subsequent motion of non-confidence. This is only 2 months before the United Kingdom is expected to officially leave the Union. The chaotic events spell considerable uncertainty with regard to the circumstances by which the UK will depart from the European Union, or even if the departure will happen, as there has been talk of a second vote on EU membership. Meanwhile, in France, yellow vest protests against austerity measures brought on by the Macron government are into their 10th week and spreading to other EU countries. And a largely underreported story, a treaty between France and Germany that would align the country's diplomatic, economic, and military policies is scheduled to be signed on Tuesday, January 22nd. Considerable questions emerge about the fate of the EU and, in fact, the purpose it serves and for whom. To explore these questions, the Global Research NewsHour reached out to a prominent writer and thinker who contributes regularly to global research and who has recently written an article entitled Europe on the Brink of Collapse. He joined us from Peru. Peter Koenig is an economist and geopolitical analyst. He's also a water resources and environmental specialist. He worked for over 30 years with the World Bank and the World Health Organization around the world in the fields of environment and water. He lectures at universities in the U.S., Europe, and South America. He's the author of Implosion, an economic thriller about war, environmental destruction, and corporate greed, fiction based on facts, and on 30 years of World Bank experience around the globe. He's also a co-author of The World Order and Revolution, Essays from the Resistance. And he is a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization. Welcome, Peter Koenig.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Now, the latest chapter in the Brexit saga played out this past week when Theresa May's failed spectacularly to get passage in the UK Parliament. Could you comment briefly on what the failure to come up with a deal means after 2 years of trying and where that leaves the UK and the EU in terms of process?
Yes, this is a very good question. I think there is no straight answer to it. I can go maybe a little bit into why Theresa may have failed to come up with what the Brits call a better deal. I think one of the reasons is that she basically is an instrument of Washington's, and so are the EU. We know that they are a bunch of vassal states, unfortunately, and therefore we never know what happened during the negotiations, during these umpteen negotiations that she carried out with Brussels. What happened behind the closed doors? You know, I have a strong impression that that of course certainly Washington doesn't want the UK to leave the EU, nor does Brussels, because they follow the dictate of the US. Nor does Brussels want them to leave. So the best option not to leave is to come up with a deal or no deal that is unacceptable for the Brits. And the Brits right now, after this vote of non-confidence, which she obviously passed, but without passing her deal or non-deal, whatever you want to call it, with the EU, leaves the Brits totally divided. I mean, it's a country in chaos. And what is easier to manage from outside than a country in chaos? And so that's where we stand right now. Whether it will eventually result in new elections, it could be, or whether in a new referendum. I think a new referendum may spark actually a civil upheaval, enormous civil upheaval, because the Brits, more than half of the Brits have decidedly voted to get out. And I think this, during these past almost 2.5 years of negotiation, has become even stronger. The desire to get out of the EU, and so this would be terrible. If it would be a new vote after a new prime minister has been sworn in, after new elections possibly, then the whole game would start again. In any case, it is a chaos, and I don't dare to predict what could come out of it in the end.
This opposition to the EU, I mean, there is a basis for it, and you're seeing displays of resistance across Europe, you know, in France with the Gilets Jaunes, and you know, in Belgium, Italy, Greece. Maybe you could comment on some of the ways in which the people's average lives have been adversely affected by the this new form of governments in the form of this European integration economically and politically.
Well, that's exactly the point. There was never really a European integration. That was a false argument and made believe to the European people that with the common currency, the euro, you could bind Europe together. That's, of course, impossible. Any serious economist will tell you that a bunch of countries that have no common constitution, have no common goals, no common vision, no strategy to look forward, no economic strategy or defense strategy, a current currency in such a bunch of countries will never work, never. And this is exactly what happens. So then with the onset of the neoliberal onset in Europe, actually every country, from Germany to Greece and to Italy and the southern countries, but also, so to some extent, northern countries have started to suffer. The people have started to suffer from these neoliberal austerity programs imposed by Brussels and, of course, helped by the IMF and the Bretton Woods institutions. So all of that has brought within the last, I would say, 10 years since the last big crisis, also an artificial crisis, since the last crisis has brought Europe in upheavals. And this is not going to stop. I don't think this is going to stop soon. And it will not stop, I think, until one of the countries, could be Italy, could be even France, or it could be eventually Greece, would drop out of the EU or of the currency. I mean, Italy has made strong moves towards wanting to get out of the euro. And if one country gets out of the euro, I think there are a number of countries that will follow. So I have very, very dim view on how the European Union and the European Community, especially the euro, is going to survive for the next generation. I don't know when the collapse will happen exactly, but I think it will happen. There is no doubt about it, because all the signals, all the indications are there that it will not be able to survive. And I mean, the thing is that the media, you know, the mainstream media, they do not cover, they do not connect the dots. But if you really look at Europe, there's everywhere, there's discontent, there's different pretexts for discontent. But the basic is the financial system. The financial system, which is totally run by banks and by banking oligarchs, those are the ones who have invented the euro, and those are the ones who have actually who are milking Europe to the bones with austerity programs. And people start feeling it, and they start just not being happy with it anymore, and they want to get out. They want to get out of this system in one way or another, whether it will be the Gilets Jaunes or the Yellow Vests, or whether it may be Brexit. And Brexit is another very strong case, where discontent is reigning. And in Germany too, I think you have more than 50% of the population who are very unhappy in Germany. There's poverty that nobody talks about it. There's poverty in France, extreme poverty in France, that of course with Macron overshadowing everything with his big words, will never get to the mainstream media. But eventually with the people in the street, this cannot be hidden anymore, and it is not going to be hidden any much longer. So I think there's going to be drastic changes in one way or another.
Could you comment then on the creation of the European Union as an institution itself? I mean, we've all heard about the signing of the Maastricht Treaty in 92 and the changes that flowed from that. But I mean, the origins really go back decades before. So I'm wondering what point in that trajectory do you get that imposition of neoliberal structural adjustment programs and this direction that the this arrangement is taken?
The European Union was never a European idea per se. It was an idea that came up probably long before this 1957 European Steel Union, in which people say, you know, that the signing of the Treaty of Rome was the first step towards the European Union. Formally, yes. But informally and in reality, this idea came up probably during the First World War already, or maybe even before, and then was implanted into the Europeans, into the European meetings to get, for example, into the Steel Union through the CIA. And through other U.S. secret services, as they were very good in doing. So this was never, the EU was never a European idea. It became then one later on, of course, with people being bought and coerced into it. But the original idea was not from the Europeans. Now, let me go back a little bit even further. People may recall Churchill's famous speech at the University of Zurich in 1946, when he spoke about Europe, steh auf, meaning get up, and he talked about the United States of Europe, he already then hinted on a common currency within Europe. And indeed, Europe had then soon, after the Marshall Plan was implemented, had a common currency, a common reconstruction currency, and that was the U.S. dollar. That was the first step for Europe to get used to having the U.S. dollar as a circulating currency within Europe, among or a sideline perhaps at the beginning of their local currencies. So this is how the whole thing started, at least being planted into Europe through Churchill's speech. And that came not, of course, out of Churchill's mind at all. This was part of a much, much larger scheme. Then, as I mentioned before, you know, then came this 1957 Belgium, France, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, the treaty that united the Europe in the Steel Union. I forgot the abbreviation is ECCS, I believe. Yeah. And then it became the European Economic Community out of that. And what did it include? It included the six countries, exactly these countries that I just mentioned before, which were part of the ECSC, the European Steel Union. So from there, then the whole construction over umpteen meetings and conferences and behind the scenes and openly were discussed until up to the 1992 Maastricht Agreement. Then there was an attempt to, of course, a false attempt to have a European constitution written in such a way that it could never be accepted by Europe, but because it would delegate practically of every country. You know, you have to see Europe as a conglomerate of countries with different cultures, different languages, and different backgrounds to large extents. So it would delegate practically their autonomy, their sovereignty to Brussels, that constitution. So it was voted out, and that was the idea, that you do not have a European constitution, because with the European constitution, Europe could indeed become a United States of Europe, which would be one economic bloc and a huge threat to the United States. So that was not desired. So, you know, and that's how it went on. The European currency, the euro, was anyway implanted and was decided on already, I think, in 1997 as a virtual currency and became a real currency, a real fiat currency, so to speak, in 2001.
Now, there's recent news of an alignment between France and Germany along economic, diplomatic, and military lines. It's a treaty that's going to be signed by the French and German leaders on Tuesday, the 22nd, in Aachen.
And I was wondering if you could comment on what that the significance of that in terms of the larger EU and whether this might be some sort of a, I don't know, an incubator for a larger military integration among the EU states.
Yes, indeed. This is a very good point because Aachen, as you know, was the capital of Charlemagne, the ancient Frankish Empire, which this emperor tried to reincarnate the Roman one, the Roman Empire. So his kingdom at that time, and that's why this Aachen meeting, that forthcoming Aachen meeting, is very symbolic. His kingdom at that time encompassed more or less the original. It was much larger, but encompassed all these original six European EU member countries. Belgium, France, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and at that time West Germany. So. Yes, it could indeed mean that there's much more behind it, because if you look at the situation of Germany, their relationship, Germany and France has is at the very low ebb at this time. You know, it has lost a lot of luster within the last few years, and especially during the Emperor Macron's year and a half in power. They have different policies. Macron tries to overwhelm Germany with the European budget, which is unacceptable. Germany rejected it. And then you have, of course, a totally different immigration policy between Germany and France. And so there's really not much left in common. So this meeting could indeed be the focus of a new military alliance between Germany and France, and eventually the rest of what will be left, or what they hope will be left of Europe. And why do I say that? Because there is, since I think about 2 years or so, maybe a little bit more, there is in Saxony-Anhalt, that's northeastern Germany, east of Hamburg, there's a military base. A German military base with the help of NATO being built for urban warfare training. It's really a training camp for urban warfare. Why would Europe need a training camp for urban warfare if they wouldn't expect upheavals that you may see in the case of Brexit? We don't know yet, that you have seen already in Greece, and that you may see more of in Greece, and that may happen in Italy. And in all those cities in Hungary, for example, or in Poland, even those cities which are these countries which are totally on the right, you know, all these upheavals, these civil upheavals, must be oppressed. I mean, Macron is the best example with the Gilets Jaunes on how to oppress people and suppress their actually peaceful demonstrations. So, yes, I think this may really be about the military integration rather than another integration. A military integration to further suppress people's civil revolutions, as I would call the Yellow Vests a revolution. So, yes, I think it goes into that direction of a military integration rather than another integration, an economic integration. You don't have to be really, it doesn't take rocket science to see that the euro and this debt-driven Western dollar-based economic system or financial system must collapse one of these days. And if this is another subject, but if you look into really what happens to the dollar, and the euro is just a small brother, the smaller brother of the dollar, then you can see that the end is in sight. And so a military integration that would oppress any civil unrest is, of course, the next step, which is planned, also, of course, helped by NATO.
Well, Peter Koenig, these events over the last week and ongoing both in Britain and France and elsewhere are really reverberating around the globe. So I want to thank you for sharing your perspectives with our audience, and I hope we can resume this conversation at a later point.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks a lot, Michael.
We've been speaking with Peter Koenig, economist and geopolitical analyst. He is a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization. He joined us from Peru. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. The Gilets Jaunes, or Yellow Vest Movement, has mobilized French citizens by the hundreds of thousands. As of November 17th, participants throughout France have been out every Saturday taking part in peaceful demonstrations, constructing barricades and blocking roads and fuel depots. They've enjoyed the support of the majority of the French population, but have faced criticism from media and state authorities. 10 civilians are known to have died and nearly 3,000 injured since the protests erupted. Who are the people behind the demonstrations, and what are they likely to achieve? The Global Research News Hour got hold of an analyst who is resident in France, who has been watching the movement very closely, to get her take. Diana Johnstone is an American political writer based in Paris, best known for her book Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusions. Johnstone is also the author of Queen of Chaos, The Misadventures of Hillary Clinton. Diana Johnstone is a past guest of the Global Research News Hour and a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization. Welcome back to the program, Diana.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Hello.
Now, we're talking about the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vests, and the roots of this go back to May, as I understand it. It started with a petition, but it really started to gain force in mid-November. And as I understand it, the trigger for the movement was the hike in fuel taxes. What can you tell us about exactly who is involved in the movement and why the protest took the form that it did?
Well, I would say that just about anybody or everybody is in the movement because it's just people, right? That category, which is forgotten with identity politics. You know, everybody has to be classified as something. This is people, right? Just ordinary people, all kinds of people. And they're just fed up with a government that seems to not care about them at all as things get worse, you see, economically and just psychologically, There's just a feeling that there isn't any democracy working, and this is sort of a revolt in favor of the restoration of some kind, perhaps a new kind of democracy.
Hmm. Well, maybe just help our listeners understand, and I mean, you kind of have a front row seat to a lot of this. Just what kinds of changes have people seen in recent years, just in terms of their what they've had to experience in their lives?
Well, for one thing, I mean, I know Macron is saying, well, but France is a very well-off society. That's really not the point. The point is not whether, it isn't that people revolt because they're poor, they revolt because they're getting poorer. You see what I mean? I mean, there are millions of people in the world, and they're in bad situations. But what happens is when you have a good standard of living, and it's just being taken away from you in various ways. Now, this is particularly a revolt of the people in smaller cities, smaller towns, villages, who have been really neglected by recent governments. I mean, not only Macron, he's just accelerated the process. And the fuel tax business came up simply because it was a last straw. It was a last straw of measures that seemed to have no concern for ordinary people. But, of course, when there's a last straw, then you find there's a whole lot of other straws underneath. You see what I mean? And so there's a whole heap of issues that come up. But this was because in the rural areas, there has been a decline of services. They've been shutting down post office shutting down hospitals, so people have to go farther to get to the hospital. The shops are closing, and you have to go to a supermarket in the countryside. So people have been forced more and more into their cars, whether they like it or not. And at the same time, the government is telling them, oh, no, naughty, naughty, mustn't use gasoline. We'll hike up the price. And this is just another example of the very contemptuous way that this establishment treats people, telling them what they should do, what they should think, without consulting them. And you see, this is particularly the hike in prices of particularly diesel fuel. And this is very annoying because for years the French government has been promoting diesel and telling people to buy diesel cars to use diesel. And all of a sudden the government turns around and says, no, 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 that you shouldn't be doing that, and make them pay for it. And the money, by the way, for this tax is not earmarked for ecological purposes, but simply another means of squeezing the public to meet the budget deficit. So it's not an eco tax. It's simply a tax on fuel that people use. And it just, I say, it was just a straw after a lot of straws that angered people, and it just has grown and grown.
Hmm. Now, this group, it's leaderless, or so we're told, and yet they have tabled specific demands, a number of them, beyond the issue of the fuel tax. Could you maybe explain just how are they able to logistically arrive at a common program?
Well, right now it's just they throw up everything with the idea that you have to sort it out later. As I wrote in my last article, there's a plan for a meeting next week of various village groups. You know, people are getting together and talking, and then they're going to start getting together in assemblies and talking some more. But precisely because there are a lot of issues, and they haven't really decided that they're demanding this or that, but there are a lot of things up in the air, the number one demand has become the Citizens Initiative referendum, so that you can solve these issues by a popular vote. And the Citizens Initiative referendum means that a large number of people you have to decide that. You have a new law for that to have, say, 700,000 or a million people signing a petition. Then you can have a referendum on that issue. Instead of, as now, the only referendums, and they're very rare, practically none, are instituted by the government itself when it feels it's going to have it wants to get public approval for something it's decided to do. But this would be to raise issues that people are concerned about. And this concern for the referendum goes back to 2005, which you could really say that this, the roots of this movement are in 2005, because President Chirac called a referendum on the new European Constitution. He called it because he was sure that with all the politicians and media saying how wonderful this was, that it would pass and he could say, you know, the people are for it, but they weren't. And that led to huge discussions all over France of people who actually read this horrible document. It was very long and legalistic and so on. And I mean, I went to several of these groups. The citizen, you know, neighborhood groups would get together and discuss this document and come up with a conclusion that they didn't like it. And so 55% of French voted against it. And what did the government do? It simply went a couple of years, and then the assembly, the representatives, voted an identical document with a different name. And so that has made people absolutely distrustful of the politicians, because they, in that case, they absolutely clearly went against the popular will.
Mm. I wonder if you could comment on
some of the differences between these manifestations, these protests, and the protests we saw a couple of decades ago around the anti-globalization and neoliberalism at that time? Because it sounds like there's definitely some overlap here.
Well, actually, there may be, but it started really with very domestic issues. Of course, implied in that is the whole globalization thing. And I think as the movement goes on and people discuss, it's a great discussion movement. I mean, these supposed demonstrations are not so much demonstrations as gatherings. People get together and they talk. I mean, even if they're in a main street or a main square or something, it's a huge amount of exchange of thoughts and ideas. And certain things are going to come out of this just because they have to, because they have to sort of realize that these policies are a product of globalization in the sense of making policies on the behalf of international capital investment. Because all these policies are made in order to lure capital investment from anywhere. And so human needs are just forgotten, and everything is decided by the markets. Now, the markets in this case don't mean the lemonade stand. The markets mean where international investment capital thinks it gets the largest profit. And now this way you can have things that are perfectly useful and even profitable, but they'll go bust because the investment wants to go somewhere where they get more of a profit. So this, in fact, means giving up your choices and just letting this abstract, anonymous movement of capital decide everything. And this is very difficult because it ends up that your politicians are only they're not deciding anything. Nobody's deciding anything. The markets are deciding things, and the politicians are just an instrument of that. And Macron is so very much an instrument of that that it's blatant.
Do you, when you go to these public, because I assume you've been exposed to some of this, what translates into media is a lot of violent confrontations. But in terms of where you've areas you've traveled, you mentioned public squares and whatnot. I suppose coffee shops. What do these discussions look like? I assume they're very. Are they heated? Are they fairly casual?
No, the discussions tend to be very friendly. This movement is obviously, the main defense of the Macron government, of Macron personally, because it's really against him, the main defense is to manage to misrepresent it to the public and to the world. Now, this representation takes place with a lot of verbal insults, which are untrue, and it also takes the part of publicizing scenes of violence. But the scenes of violence were almost exclusively caused not by the Gilets Jaunes, but by the same sort of hoodlums or vandals that come in and smash in every demonstration that they can. They have nothing to do with the Gilets Jaunes, but the second round especially, the police didn't stop them, let them burn cars, cause all kinds of damage, and then the photos of this damage are used to say, aha, the Gilets Jaunes are so violent. But in fact, it's a very peaceful movement, and it has had terrible injuries to people. I mean, there's a young woman named Fiona, for example, who's had an eye shot out by a flash ball. They're firing directly at these people who haven't done anything, and that's a kind of a provocation. But you've had like there's a in Toulouse, there's a the police fire these things which are supposed to be non-lethal, but they can wound people very heavily. And there's a man in Toulouse who actually is a fireman, and he's in a coma after being hit by a police missile. Now, normally, you know, when a fireman, that's a public servant, is wounded, why everybody rushes to his side and the government says this is terrible. Not a word. The government says nothing about all the casualties that have been caused by the missiles fired at them directly in their faces. Non-lethal, but they knock out eyes. A couple of people have lost their hands. Others have had very bad injuries. And there's not a word about this. No condolences whatsoever.
Diana, I'm reminded of back in 2010, I participated in and covered the G20 protests in Toronto, and you know, in spite of a lot of the critical perspectives and a lot of peaceful demonstrators, what dominated the headlines was the role of the Black Bloc in creating a lot of havoc and damage and whatnot, and that basically became the headline. The way the media has captured that, and in France, is it working in terms of undermining the appeal of the Yellow Vests movement?
No, but it does abroad. Maybe they'll get NATO to come in. You know, no, it's not working. It's in fact, people are very outraged. But you see, the thing is that they say that. And then it's picked up by the foreign press. You see, the foreign press mostly echoes what the national press says and shows. So, I mean, the mainstream, right? When some journalist here says something outrageous, then it's picked up by the New Republic, for instance, because that's one who does it. And repeats the lies that somebody has uttered here. And but since people are here, they see that that's not true.
Now, Diana, when you hear the term yellow vests, one thinks of the colored revolutions like the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, which have been influenced by outside forces. What assurances are there that this movement is a genuine grassroots movement and not something that's being manufactured or manipulated?
Well, I mean, anybody who says that needs to come up with a proof. You can never prove that something doesn't exist, right? Mm. I mean, this is the kind of paranoia that is going around, especially on the left. There's no sign, there's no force here that could do that, that could manufacture this, you see? I mean, you'd have to say, well, who's doing it? Come up with a hypothesis. Who's doing it? There's nobody here. The political scene is very discouraged. People, the parties, people are fed up with all of them. There just isn't a force that could invent this. Now, of course, the color revolutions were largely invented, or at least they were very heavily supported from outside, from the National Endowment for Democracy, paid for by the U.S. taxpayers, or by George Soros, so they're working hand in hand in order to overthrow governments the U.S. doesn't like. Well, that's not the case here. Here, something is really happening. And the fact that it arouses suspicion, it's just that the suspicion is misplaced. That's not the case here. I say anybody who wants to make that accusation has to be a little more precise. Who do they think is doing it?
Okay. So could you talk then a little bit more about the police tactics? And I know we've seen over the course of the last 9 weeks the police and security forces, because I think that they've got a large number of them, but are they not inviting forces from outside of France to participate in this?
Not that I know. No. I mean, I don't see how they could do that. I mean, no. It's just the police tactics have really been, and I, you know, this comes from the top of the government. You can't. A lot of people like that. That like this girl named Fiona, this young woman who lost an eye. She made a very touching interview. She said she was a little bit annoyed with the policeman who fired the gun at her, but she realized it wasn't the fault of the police, that they're there doing their job. And so that's a very different attitude from the black box who consider the police their enemy and start fighting them, you see. There's no resemblance here between the... these are just ordinary citizens who have... problems.
It's clear that the Macron government is trying to wage something of a counterinsurgency, which, you know, one of the tactics that's typically involved would be what you'd call agents provocateurs. So
actually, I haven't seen much of that. I can expect that will come along, unless you call a black box type of people.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, there are some people who say, I mean, there are people who've taken a photograph of a policeman throwing a rock through a store window. In other words, the certain branches of the police are paid to cause damage that can be attributed to the Gilets Jaunes. But as far as infiltration of provocateurs, I haven't seen that yet. I think that this is, takes the government completely by surprise, and they don't have the personnel on hand for that. Anything is possible because, but you see, this movement is really characterized by just normal people's common sense. They realize that the police are trying to what they're trying to do. They catch on. I mean, these are not stupid people. These are ordinary, normally intelligent people, and they're not that easily fooled or led this way or that way. And they're all very suspicious of leaders and politicians because they feel that all of them end up doing the same thing, and they just don't trust them. That's why they are going to try to develop their own movement. Everything says that this is in for the long haul, that they are meaning to keep at this and figure out exactly how to get their thoughts and demands across. And that's why the referendum, since the referendum is an institutional idea, it has sort of become the main demand. Because it sees it as an instrument to express themselves.
It seems, yeah, you mentioned an instrument, and it seems like this Yellow Vest movement, the Gilets Jaunes, is a brand new way of organizing the working class. The trade unions appear to have become irrelevant in this process in terms of leadership. What does that say about traditional organizing, and what lessons can we learn from it?
Well, that's a big question. I would say this: the trade unions have been one thing that has to do with the transformation of the economy. Now, I wouldn't say that France is totally deindustrialized, but relatively, it's deindustrialized. And you have to think back. I mean, when Karl Marx was the point of the working class was when you had big factories full of workers, and they could shut down production and make the capitalists lose money. And that was an instrument of power. But you don't have that anymore because a lot of industry has been automated. There aren't so many groups of workers, and a lot of workers that have gone on strike are service workers. Well, they can go on strike in the trains or this or that, and who pays? Not the guy. It's the people, who ordinary people traveling around, who suffer, And it doesn't ruin capitalism particularly. And so, in fact, the working class is no longer, to think of the working class in terms of factories is just to say, well, we've lost, right? I mean, if the left can only think of the working class in terms of factories, they might as well pack up and go home, which is pretty much what they have done. But the working class now is all kinds of people. It's somebody delivering the pizza. People taking care of old people and children, and so it's all kinds of, it's scattered. The working class is scattered, and the idea, I think, from the top and from the capitalists is great. They'll never get together because they're scattered, and actually they have gotten together, and that's quite remarkable, because there are more of them than of the classical factory workers. Now there are many more of them, and they're all if they're not necessarily employees, but suppose they're a little shopkeeper. Well, the little shopkeeper is working for the bank because he had to make a huge loan in order to open his shop, and he's really been working for the bank. So the nature of capitalism has changed, and the movement corresponds to that extremely well.
Hmm. Well, I'm reminded of the Occupy Wall Street movement in the United States, which took off for a while, but it was eventually crushed, I think we can say. What are your – when you look at the Yellow Vest movement, what are the prospects? Is it going to be crushed like Occupy Wall Street was?
Well, no, because, look, Occupy Wall Street – I mean, I wasn't there, so you know more about that than I do. But as I understand, it was a lot of people who stopped everything and went and sat down in the squares or something like that. But this is to start with. This is every Saturday, so you know people can do their job and then go on Saturday. So that's different from regular strikes too, because you see, if you go on strike, then the workers get no pay, and then after a while, they don't want to keep on going on strike because they're not getting any pay. But this type of working class can go once a week, and it's not losing anything much, except you know. Maybe a little bit, but so the very way it's structured of every week prepares it for a much longer haul than a strike that goes out to shut something down, including one's own job, for an indefinite period. You see,
but
Occupy, I don't know, because Occupy was, I don't know. For one thing, I can't compare, because I think they're very, very, very different. And you've got to realize that France is very, very different. Mm. And, I mean, it annoys me because I know that the Anglo-Saxons, as they call them, the British, just don't understand France very well. And they don't understand the situation. And they're ready to suspect the worst. And that's something I want to say. I mean, I'm just outraged by all of these leftists who are searching around to see, oh my goodness, you know, there's somebody who's racist. This is a left that has nothing to offer anymore, but acts as an inquisitor. And every time there's a movement, their only interest is, oh, let's go and find out if there's a racist or homophobe or anti-Semitic or something like that. They just act like nothing but inquisitors and are unable to see the reality. Now, I think this is a much more national movement. I don't think Occupy was a national movement, but the United States is much bigger. So you see, the comparison is very difficult, mm-hmm. because France, you have these demonstrations all over the country, and also there's a French tradition of well, it's a myth. It's a myth about revolutions and all that. But it sometimes works in the sense that people think, well, you know, this is something the French do, and you don't have that in the United States or other places.
Okay. Well, Diane, I think we're going to have to leave it there. But I want to thank you very much for sharing those insights with our audience.
Well, you're very welcome.
We've been speaking with Diana Johnstone. She's a political writer based in Paris, and she's a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization.